Well, a lot of them are on the, some people I speak to. Okay, good afternoon, everybody. We are ready for the afternoon portion of the Reliability Tech Conference. And this one is going to involve a panel. Group number two, MISO, Xcel, Otter Tail Power, MDU, and Minn Kota with Cass Electric. So we've got a nice spread of people in front of us, a couple online, JT and Scott from MISO. Appreciate you guys participating, and I understand you also listen to a lot of the morning as well, so you have some context there to go by. We're going to keep the format very similar to how Randy's was, where we're not going to do any organized presentations. We'll just have a free flow of conversation with some questions. I want to encourage Randy and Brian, if you have questions along the way, just go ahead and jump in. I'll try to keep an eye on you. And the same for staff. If you guys have any questions, I welcome you to jump in and go ahead and ask. But we'll kind of follow the same format and the agenda that was followed this morning. And I might ask for across the board comments on some of the questions, just because I do like hearing the different takes on the same answer. So just because one person spoke, don't think you're all off the hook. So with that, I think we will, I'll ask you each, if you can remember when you first start speaking, to introduce yourself. And then as far as MISO folks, JT and Scott, you guys can work it out with Brian and Allison however you like. If you want to, if you hear a question that's yours, you can go ahead and jump in, because it is, there isn't much of a delay, or you can have Brian and Allison call on you. I'm comfortable either way. So the first question, we'll start out generally talking about the February event, emergency operations and communications, and kind of start with that and then kind of expand back as we go to resource adequacy and some of those bigger, broader market and planning questions. But let's start with the February event first. And it was a different experience in MISO versus SPP, but I think the analysis that needs to occur as a result is very similar. And I think I can rest assured, I think that all of you are looking at what happened and examining your own operations in view of that, those things, and looking at where your vulnerabilities might exist. So the first question we kind of asked for framing the discussion this afternoon is, what do you see as the main cause or big takeaways from the February cold weather event? And we specifically said, besides the fact that it's cold, because quite honestly, that is nothing new here. And we all know that winter is cold, so we need to plan and prepare for that. It was cold elsewhere, but besides the issues, the cold in the south, what are the big causes or takeaways? And we'll go ahead and start with MISO and then probably just work our way across the panel.
Thank you, Commissioner Fedorchak. And let me just start by saying thank you to the whole commission for doing this conference. This is a timely set of questions and an important topic. So thanks for inviting us here today. Your first one is right up JT Smith's alley. So I'm going to pass it directly to JT and let him dive in there. Thanks.
Appreciate it, Brian. Can you all hear me okay?
We can. And why don't you give us your title too, JT, as you start?
Excellent. Sure will. My name is JT Smith. I'm the Senior Director of Operations Planning and Real-Time Operations at MISO. And being from the Gulf Coast originally, I would argue that it was a little bit chilly for those of us from that neck of the woods. When you get something below 35 degrees, we do not like it in the South. So, but when we talk about the event and really what the drivers were, it ultimately comes down to generation performance under a number of different conditions. MISO's footprint, very diverse in climate and distance, where my north region not necessarily is impacted by cold, but impacted by fuel supply, much like you heard Lanny talk about this morning, natural gas fuel supply The wind resources, wind was down as well. That's something you tend to see when you are in. Now, did wind underperform, overperform? It performed basically where we would have expected it to be from a capacity credit. I believe Lanny also mentioned that this morning. It wasn't too far off where we would expect on that end. But when we get to these extreme cold, and I'll say extreme cold from a footprint perspective, that's kind of where we were sitting. You do see loads pick up. You do see generation performance go down. One of the things that I think you can point to across the MISO footprint are our more northern region utilities tend to perform better in the cold, especially even with the natural gas fleet that may have had some restrictions in fuel supply. We have a lot of backup fuel capability in our north region. I believe that you have a couple folks sitting at your table that have a significant amount of backup fuel, and that was essential in keeping the MISO North region sufficient during this time period. Another driver that caused MISO to see some events was just transmission capability. We were wheeling significant amounts of energy from PJM into MISO, PJM through MISO to over to SVP. Those wheels and those transfers coming in stressed a system that wasn't necessarily designed to transfer power from east to west, but to just more of a pick up power from our low cost coal and wind regions to deliver to the rest of the footprint. So we saw significant impacts associated with, to the point where we ran into a transmission emergency that resulted in a capacity deficiency call in our north region. MISO has a maximum generation events that is how we declare our EEA alert levels. We did actually have to step into those for our north region for a short period of time because we didn't have the transmission system available to deliver the capacity that was available to in the eastern part of our footprint. So a lot of drivers overall. In the south footprint, the cold, it did get a little bit cold for them down there, and we did see generation performance, less fuel supply, but more cold weather impacts for the south region. And that ultimately resulted in a capacity deficiency that resulted in a temporary load shed from a resource adequacy or resource availability perspective. We also saw a number of localized load sheds throughout our footprint that were all about managing the transmission because of what we were seeing in east to west flows and impacting the operations of our system.
Thank you, JT. So because while that information is fresh, I might also just expand into the second question, which is what is your role in addressing these issues? Or if there are any kind of like quick immediate takeaways that you already know that MISO is going to be doing as a response to this, if you could add those to the mix, and then we'll kind of go through both of the cause and the solutions together as we talk about this.
Yeah, so some of it comes down to MISO situational awareness and being readily of it and readily know how the fleet is going to react. We've been doing surveys for the last few years in regards to winterization as well as natural gas fuel supply in regards to what kind of contracts our members have, what kind of backup capabilities do they have. That provided situational awareness for us that in our north central region specifically, when we started seeing operational flow orders come across pipelines, we were able to look at our survey and say, hey, these 10 units sit on this pipeline, they have interruptible service, let's go call them and see if they're going to be available. And when we get in touch with them, they come back and say, oh no, you're right, we're not going to be available. Rather than wait for you to call us, we'll go ahead and go enforce outage now, which is important because that allows us to make sure we're committing the right resources, the right surplus on the system to meet some of these uncertainties that we knew we were going to get into. We have experiences from an operational perspective that when it does get cold in general, it doesn't have to be extreme cold. It just needs to be cold that sometimes units struggle to start up if they haven't been running for a while. So it allows us to think about those units and make earlier commitments as necessary to check with those units that have dual fuel supply. Just are your diesel tanks warm? Because I don't want a frozen diesel fuel that happened to us a couple years ago because we got caught off guard. Is that warmed up, ready to go so that we can be available in case you don't get natural gas? So situational awareness for MISO is huge on that end, and getting better situational awareness is going to be important going forward. I think as you heard much in Lanny's conversation, we don't have, we operate the fleet that is provided to us. We don't decide what that fleet looks like. We don't do the maintenance on it. We don't own any of those assets, but we operate the fleet that is provided to us. And from my perspective, the biggest thing is for us to understand operational capability, availability, and making sure that when I needed to control reliability of the transmission system, that I can depend on it. There are other things that I think we need to look at in a going forward nature as well around our capacity emergency procedures. If you look at, and I know it might get touched on a little bit later, but in the resource adequacy construct at MISO, we have a significant amount of behind the meter generation, demand response, I think we call those LMRs, that sit behind our emergency calls. So sometimes I can't get to my entire reserve fleet unless I'm in a capacity emergency to call upon. So there's little things like that that you'll see. I would love to have better access from a market side of some of those resources rather than having to be in a capacity emergency to access 15 gigawatts of capacity that is provided to us through the resource adequacy construct. It would be nice to be able to operate that without always having to be in emergency procedures. And I know we heard this morning, we heard SPP talk about maybe very rarely being in EEA situations. Well, in parts of our footprint, we're in them quite a bit because you run out of your dispatchable fleet and then you have to get into your LMRs, your load modifying resources, and that takes a capacity emergency to do so. And I can understand in some cases where you kind of start feeling numb to what that is because you get into a quote unquote emergency, but yet nothing happens out of that day. So it's those procedures need to be looked at and thought about as well. Overall, the rest of it is trying to ensure that we are providing our members a good construct and coordination for being able to maintain their fleet. And recognizing also, I think going forward, as Scott will probably approach later, is making sure that we're accrediting units appropriately and we mm-hmm. understand truly what the performance capability is gonna be.
Great, and we will get to that later, Scott, so hold that thought. All righty, thank you, JT. Any questions, follow-up for JT, for either of you guys? Okay, then we'll move on to XL, Carolyn. And if you have other people on the line you want to call in, please feel free to do that.
I certainly do have several friends available to help me out here. So lessons learned, MISO has their emergency operating processes that worked really well. We were in communication following those processes. Leading up to the event, it was really helpful. We took steps on our transmission operations side to make sure that the system stayed intact during the emergency. We did some last minute inspections. We may have returned equipment into service earlier than planned to prepare for those emergency situations. And then on the fleet side, we've got a diverse set of resources, and we were able to do some managing of those resources to really help us out during this event. And I would actually like to phone one of those friends, mm-hmm. Carrie Hassler, to talk a little bit about what we did to move some of the stuff around that really helped us out during that emergency.
That'd be great. Carrie?
Okay, my camera's trying to connect. Sorry, it's a little slow. There we go. Hello, everybody.
Hi, Carrie.
Hi.
You sound great.
Great, thank you. Appreciate that. Like Carolyn said, we do have a diversified fleet of resources, and they did perform well due to the preparations that we have maintained long-term, such as weatherization of our plants and preparations that we made in the near term as well. We did take some actions outside of MISO's instructions to increase the reliability during this cold weather time, such as self-committing all of our coal units, and we also self-committed or kept our combined cycles online as well. In addition, there were peaking units that we would bring on in the warmer parts of the day to ensure that they were on and available during the coldest parts of the day. We did rely very heavily on our oil units, both those units that are dual fuel and those that are fuel oil only. And that helped us mitigate the increase in the gas cost. It was tricky because we wanted to use those fuel oil resources as much as we could, but there were limits. We were burning through the fuel oil quicker than it could be delivered. The deliveries were sporadic and intermittent. We weren't exactly sure when they were going to occur at all times. We had fuel emissions that also had to be managed. And so I think our operations group did a very good job of managing around all of those constraints and ensuring that we could use those fuel oil resources at the time when they were needed the most. We did have one instance that I always try to call out because I think it's a very successful story to publish is we weren't expecting one of our gas units to be committed by MISO. It was committed. We had some gas supply issues that would have pushed us into the penalty gas prices. And so we transitioned one of our resources that was on gas at the time. We transitioned that to fuel oil while it was running so that the gas could be transitioned to the unit that was committed by MISO and the other unit could run on fuel oil. So it was kind of that quick thinking and out of the box thinking that our operations group was dealing with in the near term beyond the preparations that they made prior to the event. As far as lessons learned, I've gone over several of them. The other piece that we did is we just cut our wind forecast to zero for this event. Going back to the January 30th, 2019 event, there were issues with icing and curtailments for cold. And so we decided going into this event, we would just assume that no wind was available. And that helped us prep the amount of thermal generation that we needed going into the event. Our wind actually performed, as others have said, near their capacity accredited value, but we were prepared if they didn't perform at all.
Okay, thank you, Carrie. One quick follow-up. Can you tell us how, were your nuclear and coal fleets running maximum gen, and how many megawatts was that?
I'm assuming the nuclear was definitely running max gen. That's about 1800 megawatts. The coal units, there were a few derates. They had some frozen coal issues. So they took some slight derates there, but if off the top of my head, I would say we were near maximum capacity. For specifics, I'd have to go back and look at the values, but our coal capacity, installed capacity, is around 2,400 megawatts. So we were probably in that ballpark for most of the time.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Mm-hmm. All righty, moving on to MDU, Darcy, MJ.
Yeah, Darcy's sidekick here.
Yeah.
Jay Scable, Vice President of Electric Supply at MDU. I'll give just a little bit of a summary on our generation fleet and how it performed, and turn the system operations questions over to Darcy. So big question, I think, has been coal. How does our coal units operate? We've got four coal units. The two that are co-owned and operated by our friends from Otter Tail ran fine, had no problems. We got full supply from those. Our Heskett 1 unit ran fine. Our Heskett 2 unit was derated from 75 to 61 megawatts prior to this event, but ran fine at the derated 61 megawatts throughout the event. Our Lewis and Clark unit, which is now retired, in its, second to last month of operation, was basically shut down prior to the to this event due to low water levels in the Yellowstone River. So the unit had been off prior to the cold snap and did not run, until the very end of the cold snap. our gas units. We had some issues. Also, we'll start with the Lewis and Clark unit. That also, that gas unit was also off due to low river levels, not because the unit couldn't run, but because we didn't have any water for fire suppression and were, you know, are not allowed to run in that condition. We have two units at Glendive, Montana. Those two both had mechanical issues. One had a breaker issue, which we think was probably cold related. And the other one had multiple minor issues, mechanical issues that happened periodically. It ran for a while, had an issue, ran for a while, had an issue. So it was not on full time. It did have some of those cold weather issues that I think JT was referring to. A potential solution there would be to run those units as a must run in advance, a day or two or hours anyway, before the cold snap hit. We think that would probably would have helped. Then our Heskett 3 unit did not run during the majority of the event because of pricing, gas pricing, well, gas and market pricing. It was finally called on the last day of the cold snap when the prices came in line. But that was a unit that was available, ready to run, but due to pricing just was not called on. If it would have been called on, it would have run, and it did on that last day. And then our wind farms, we have three wind farms. They all performed above accredited capacity, which was, I think we thought was pretty miraculous, I guess, because the temperatures at those wind farms did get down to 37 below at one point. And I think you've probably heard from the other cold snap events that we've had and had discussions on. It seems like minus 22, minus 23 is about where wind farms will not start up. What we were fortunate in this event that the wind blew steady throughout and kept those machines warm enough that they ran through the whole thing and did perform a bit better than accredited. So we're pretty happy there. And then just overall on our transmission system, you know, equipment-wise, performed fine, didn't have any issues equipment-wise at all. I'll turn it over to Darcy for the system operations.
Okay, thank you, Jay. My name is Darcy Nigam with Montana Dakota Utilities. I'm the Director of Electric System Operations and Planning. So from the standpoint of our electric system, you know, the system performed very well. You know, we had gotten the notifications through the capacity and energy emergency procedures from ISO. We're passing that information along out to our field personnel. And so we're at least aware of potentials, you know, for events that could come, and we're waiting, you know, in case something did arise, which did not occur. So the system performed well. We did not have any outages that impacted customer service on our transmission or distribution system. So things held well. From a standpoint of load, loads were high, but they were certainly still below what our all-time winter peaks were. So we didn't set an all-time winter peak or even a system peak condition. You know, the one thing that probably, you know, impacted us briefly was we did have a community that was impacted by the load sheds that Western Area Power Administration was going through. And so, you know, in our minds, they inappropriately interrupted service to one of our communities. So once we were able to get a hold of them and explain that it was MISO load, and they thought about it, it's not SPP load, it wasn't doing them any good to interrupt service, at least for MISO customer load. So I think they kind of realized that, and at least we didn't have any other issues with them after that. And that was just the community of Kildare. So we had lost about 3 to 5 megawatts early on that Tuesday morning.
Darcy, a follow-up to that, how long were they off, and did you, is that communication gap, like, fixed, or is that, like, how does that not get repeated?
So the amount of time was about 40 to 50 minutes is what the community was out. We ended up getting word what had happened really through some of the local service employees that we have in the town of Kildare. You know, we were trying to get a hold of Western Area Power Administration, and they were not answering our phone calls once we were trying to figure out what was going on. And we remained persistent. A few others did. The manager of our control room kept calling repeatedly. Eventually, once we got through, explained to them, and they thought about it for a while. I think they were thinking, you know, that all load was the same, in which case it's not. So I think that message has been passed along to them, and it's certainly one of those finer pieces we still have, you know, I think through one of those lessons learned to make sure there's an understanding. You know, on our side, we identify which breakers would have load that's both MDU and, you know, Wanna Basin's members. In this case, there was a breaker that was opened, you know, by WAPA that had, you know, MISO load on it. And so it's one of those things I think it's corrected, but we'll certainly follow up on. The other thing, as Jay has mentioned, the other biggest pieces probably of impacts were just where natural gas prices were. You know, in the case of the Heskett unit, you know, it was available to run, could have run. You know, we get an agreement through a marketer to get transportation and gas, and those prices, whether it's speculative or not, went really high at the start of this. And so the unit sat there, was available, and if market prices on the electric side would have gotten high enough, it would have gotten a start. But we never got to those levels to see that.
Good. Thank you.
In that WAPA situation, does MDU inject a certain amount of energy into WAPA's lines that is supposed to kind of balance out what some of those MDU communities use? Or is are their lines charged completely through their own system and Basin Electric's generation?
So we have arrangements, and it's probably similar to others on this table, where we take transmission service, at least from a Basin or Western Area Power Administration through SPP. Likewise, they take service from us for some of their loads. You know, the load that is taking that service is provided from the MISO market. And so there's at least a way that captures that energy that's required by those customers, and it's delivered from MISO's balancing authority. So the energy to provide those customers ultimately is injected, you know, through MISO's balancing authority and supplies the energy. It's just a transmission path that we end up taking for the last mile to basically get to those customers.
I'm trying to justify in my mind the distinction, I guess, between that separation where they're running short of energy, so all of the SPP customers shed to save what's left for the MISO customers off of the same transmission line. But then, like what we discussed this morning, when SPP is doing the load shed, it doesn't matter that an area is generation sufficient. They share the same shed as those that are generation inefficient. So I guess I'm still trying to figure out what's the right thing to do there. But
and Commissioner Christman, it becomes a balancing authority. You know, who's responsible to know what the load is and as far as where the generation they get to serve that load? So from the standpoint, MISO and their balancing authority had an ability to get energy to serve all of the MISO load. You know, as we heard this morning, there was a generation deficit on the SPP side. So from their BA side, they were unable to serve those requirements for the load, which got into the load shed event.
Thank you.
All righty. Otter Tail Power, anything new and different? And then kind of give us the rundown.
Sure. Bill Swanson, Manager of Supply Engineering and Operations. I'll just comment quickly about our generation. As Jay mentioned, Big Stone and Coyote both online and we're operating well as our small coal plant in Fergus Falls. We have about 140 megawatt coal, actually two units in Fergus Falls, and it was online and operating. We have a small natural gas unit in northern Minnesota. It's about 40 to 50 megawatts. It operated on natural gas, and I think, you know, allow me to be wrong if possible, but I think for the first time it was called on to operate on oil. So we have backup fuel oil up at Solway, and it was called on to operate on oil. It came online, operated on oil, came off again, and then was called on again on oil. And during the second operation, we had a valve fail that we could not operate that plant. And through some sort of creative work and working with the equipment supplier, we found a solution to that. We're able to isolate it again and at least get it back up and ready to go for natural gas. And it did fire on natural gas after that as well.
One quick question on that. Was it chosen by MISO to run on oil?
It was.
And is that because of supply or why do they care?
It was price. It was
price.
Right. Our oil fired peakers were available and did operate, and our wind farms, we were right on the border of the temperature restriction. And so I would say one of our four plants did trip off due to low temperature. And then I just add, at the same time, we were starting up our new natural gas peaker down at Astoria, South Dakota. During that time period, we opted to stop doing testing on there just because we saw what was happening with pricing with natural gas. So we halted that process and sort of let things settle out for about a week.
Is that a dual fuel?
It's not a dual fuel unit.
What's okay.
Maybe we could talk about more of that later.
Future question.
Yeah.
In a different venue. Like, what do you need to make that fuel? Dual fuel.
And I'll turn it to Tom for transmission.
Tom Rulichka, my title is Manager of System Operations. So I operate our real-time operations center. So I was pretty busy on both of these days. I think two big takeaways from our perspective. One is the importance of doing lessons learned on the heels of these types of events. Some of the things that we learned in the polar vortex in January of 2019, we implemented those. This go around, we were very successful in operating our transmission system. A lot of the things that you would normally see happen during a cold stretch that lasts this long, we just didn't see happen on our system. We have a number of high voltage breakers that require a special gas to be able to operate properly. And that gas requires heating so that it can function. And a lot of the winterization that we did, which was a lessons learned in 2019, we had zero problems with our gas breakers. Our heaters worked properly because we had gone around and tested all of them in the fall. We had extra puck heaters on hand to add supplemental heat where needed. So I think that those lessons learned exercises are so valuable because we really weathered this event very well. Our system held up unexpectedly well. We had zero customer outages except for we were also impacted by erroneous load shedding by WAPA. Our community of Velva was shed for about 30 minutes. We too were on the phone with that very busy control center that morning. Explaining to them some of the paragraphs in their own load shedding plan and what those specifically mean, which leads me to my second takeaway, is that I think all of us could do a better job on training and preparedness for capacity load shedding events. I think we do a very good job at preparing our operators for transmission reliability, power restoration drills. In fact, some of those are required by NERC standards. They're required to participate in power restoration drills every fall. MISO offers, in fact, today is the sixth consecutive Thursday that MISO has offered capacity emergency event drill training for operators. It's been going on for the last six Thursdays, and utilities participate in those voluntarily. We're not required to. But I think we could probably take those capacity energy emergency drills a little further and also get all the players involved in North Dakota. And I think this inadvertent load shed could have been averted.
Excellent. That's a great point. And I think that helps this kind of a conversation today helps us too as regulators be more informed when you come in front of us with like, oh, requests for dual fuel capacity or something. It's like, you won't probably get an automatic no, that costs too much when we have, you know, experience in conversations like this. So, okay, very good. How about Minn Kota and Cass Electric?
Good afternoon. My name is Todd Seiler. I'm the Senior Manager of Power Supply at Minn Kota Power. I guess I would say one of the key takeaways when you look back at the event was maybe the duration of the event. I would say what our load was the highest the week before. I would say the region experienced the really cold temperatures and the event where they had problems on the resource side. So we were fortunate that really at the time we were starting to warm up, is when the event for the most part occurred. For us, we don't have natural gas. We have baseload resources that are coal. They are all in mine mouth. So we're very fortunate in that we didn't have the fuel supply issues there because of the fuel supply being right at the plant. We did have our WAPA allocations that, you know, we did have a few hours where we had a reduction in that. But for most part, we received all that allocation during the event as well. The one thing is that we did utilize our demand response program, which is registered as an LMR. So we have the ability to control 30 to 40% of our load in the winter. And so we were using that during the event, you know, and all that has to be communicated with MISO. So MISO is only going to operate a system as well as the information that they have. So when the fact that we have it registered as a load modifying resource, we have to communicate when we're using it, what's available. But we did utilize that. I would say that was one of the things that you learn in all these events is just the communications of these different assets, how to communicate a demand response program. It is something that we do, but sometimes it gets confused when people start hearing firm load shed. They get that confused with a demand response program that is designed to do exactly that as far as reducing your load obligation during these events. So in some ways, we use it similar to almost like a peaker to where it limits our exposure to the market. So it is the one thing that we're in a process of updating. So we did a lot of testing just to make sure it works. So when you take a system like that apart and put it back together, it performed very well. And we were very fortunate. And so for the most part, we were very fortunate that our resources performed pretty well. Our wind, I would say, is similar to everybody else. We had times, I would say, at the start of the event where we had really low wind and with temperatures where we did not have wind. But for the most part, it was low for the duration of the event. That being said, Cass, you had one load that was interrupted for a short period from the SPP. But other than that, we didn't have any firm load sheds on our system.
One quick follow-up for Marshall. Todd, on the demand response, did you have any customers say, wait a minute. I mean, we don't want to be kicked off at this time. Right. we do it some other time, but not what we signed up for.
We always get that, but but we've been doing this for many years. So a lot of our customers, unless they've moved in from, you know, a new house or something, they're familiar with our program is, and it is something that we utilize. And I would say one of the things that these events have allowed us to do is to exercise that program. So our system is designed for like 500 hours in the winter, but because of the market conditions and the amount of renewables, we have not utilized that as much as we have in the past. So customers maybe aren't as prepared as maybe they were 10, 15 years ago. That being said, they do have backup fuel. So it is designed to where they're really not inconvenienced to a point where they don't have heat. So most of it is dual fuel or storage or that type of load that allows us to lower our load obligation. For the most part, we were actually providing resources to the market during the event. So like I said, we were very fortunate.
Anything to add, Marshall?
Commissioners, Marshall Albright, President and CEO of Cascone Electric Cooperative. I too want to just thank you for putting this event together. I think it's really important that we share this message with not only the people in this room, but our communities. And we've been working hard to do that ourselves. And I think we'll continue to do that to make sure that the community or the residents in North Dakota, they know this issue because it's really, really important to their future to make sure we keep our power costs as low as possible. Two points to add. One, load management. We've had load management in our system for just about 40 years, since the 70s, and it's been a phenomenal system to be able to use. We have the ability, like Todd said, to shed load during an event like this to help out not only MISO, but to help keep our members' rates low. So we offer rate incentives for our larger commercial accounts to go on a system like this, where we can shed their load maybe 20 to 50 hours a year, roughly. And they expect that, you know, when weather conditions are such that we need to shed load, we call on them to do that. In return, they save 20, 30% on their bills. So that's something we've had in place for a long time, had great success with that program. We have over 150 of our commercial accounts that are set up that way right now, where they have diesel generators in place as a backup source. So it works good in situations like this to be able to shed load like in an instant. And that's very valuable and something we'll continue to promote. Just one last thing, you know, as far as the, you know, takeaways from this event, I think, you know, communication is a problem in life. When you don't communicate, problems happen. And I think we've learned that better communication needs to happen in all areas, you know, be it through the RTOs, the to WAPA, to Minn Kota, to us, to our membership. You know, I think the members don't understand how this stuff works. I was here this morning and there were some comments brought up how complicated our industry is. It is so true, but it's also very complicated to get that message out to the general public to understand the issues that we face trying to plan for the future when the future is uncertain. We don't really know what the future is going to expect from a power supply policy perspective. So how can we plan for something when we don't know what the rules are going to be? So anyway, interesting topic. I thanks again for having us today because I think it's really important.
Maybe this is better for the resource adequacy time, but the demand response issue was brought up by both Tom and Marshall. And so I'm wondering, I think, two things. First of all, Tom, you mentioned someone's house, but is the bulk of that commercial or residential? And then do, especially in the commercial area, do most of these entities then shut down for that 50 to 100 hours a year? Or are those things that have their own backup generators?
I would say it's both. So when you look at on the large commercial side, typically they're going to have generators as backup, and they would have the abilities to not shut down. So that is one of the things on the commercial side. So I would say our demand response is both commercial and residential. So there is a side that Marshall just touched on, and then there's the residential side. So on the residential side, a number of our customers have what's referred to as dual fuel. So they'll have a propane backup furnace. And so they have propane, and when we basically curtail the electric side, which supplies electricity to them 95% of the time, then they just switch to the backup fuel. So they don't see a change in temperature in the houses. The other would be storage type, slab heat, brick heaters, water heaters, stuff like that. So I would say our demand response, we focus pretty much on all sectors, commercial and residential. We feel it's a big part of managing a portfolio. So it's allowed us to not have to build other resources because it lowers your load obligation. That's a way. And another thing is most of our control is capable of controlling within 10 minutes. So when we demonstrate, do our performance measurement, we demonstrate that we can control all that load within 10 minutes. So it's very responsive.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that was enlightening. Thank you for all those good takeaways and more clarity on what was working and where the challenges were. So the next question that we kind of threw out there was load shed. Now, this might not have been as relevant in the MISO area or region for this event, but I do think it's still appropriate to revisit this. And as you hit on demand response, I'd like you also to comment. I know this is an area that MISO's looked at a lot, and JT mentioned it earlier, just like wanting earlier access to those resources that exist. And so I'd like to, in the whole load shed discussion, explore the demand response a little bit more, because personally, I feel like that's low-hanging fruit that's out there that hasn't been tapped, and that we could make it more, you know, collaboratively, the utilities, the RTOs, the state regulators, make more of a concerted attempt to tap into that resource that exists. And so I'd like you to talk about kind of general load shed plans, how that would work if we had to do that in MISO, and what are you doing to pursue sort of a more aggressively tapping into demand response resources that could exist. And we can, if it's okay, maybe we'll just follow the same order. Does that work?
Okay. Sure. Commissioner Dorchek, this is Brian Tullo. I'm going to turn that again to JT right away. Before I do that, though, I wanted to add a data point to support what you just heard as far as the operation of the coal fleet up here during that time period that we just talked about. In my legislative testimony earlier, we pulled some numbers to look at fuel mix in the MISO North region in particular during the event. And it was a pretty stark difference from a normal winter. In other words, on a normal winter, which was pretty much January and December before that, we were in the roughly 35% coal as part of our mix. But in those 3 days in February, coal was almost 60% of the fuel mix in MISO North. So we as an operator were leaning heavily on coal, and that is primarily was primarily at the expense of gas, frankly, because everybody was doing everything they could to not run on gas there. But I think you heard, you know, some really good stories about the efforts to keep those units available and or operate the gas units on fuel oil, which we heard a lot also. So sorry for that sojourn, but I just wanted to cap off the last discussion with that comment.
Thank you.
And then we'll turn it over to JT for the load shed.
Before you get to that, well, I guess it's kind of load shed, but on that 65%, do you have any, or 60% of?
It was 58% to be
58%.
Exact.
58%. Do you have any sense of what percent of that is scheduled to retire within like the next decade?
I don't. In general, it's, I think we're, from what we know, as far as units plan to retire, a significant portion of that would be
offline.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, JT.
Yeah, sure thing. So I want to kind of step up a little bit on, there are two instances in which MISO would direct load shed of its customers. And I think you kind of heard a little bit of what those two issues would be in regards to the, I think some of the miscommunication on the WAPA load shed and the SPP footprint that included a little bit of the MISO load. So we would shed load for two reasons. One is for capacity insufficiency on the system, basically meaning you don't have enough generation or import capability to meet your load obligations. The second one would be to manage the transmission system and to ensure that you are not violating or getting to a point of widespread uncontrolled load shed. So you may have local load shed issues to manage transmission loading or transmission issues that get more localized and aren't as widespread. So in this cold weather event, MISO actually had, I want to say, five unique load shed situations. We had four that were transmission related to avoid inadvertent uncontrolled load shed. One was done in Illinois based off of significant constraints that were being impacted by significant east to west flows and a couple transmission and generation trips in the area. We had to do a localized load shed that only impacted one utility locally for that end. In the South, we had, I want to say, three additional events that a couple of them were localized in our Texas area. And then we had one that impacted the entire state of Louisiana, which at that point, it was localized only to Louisiana to manage that transmission, but it was a load ratio share of those utilities or those LBAs, local balancing authority areas, that could impact and support the reduction of risk that we had on those transmission lines. The other load shed that we have is for that capacity deficiency situation, and that did happen in our South region on the evening of the 16th. And on that evening, we did shed 700 megawatts of load because we ran out of import capability and generation to meet our needs. The important aspect of the load shed is just recognizing how the communication goes from the control room perspective. In a localized transmission situation, you'll have control rooms talking with the localized control rooms. It'll be a reliability coordinator to reliability coordinator conversation, talking about and trying to work through solutions to do everything you can to not shed the load. But at some point in those types of situations, you've gotten to the point where there's nothing else you can do, and you've got to remove that risk on the system, because That risk, that uncontrollable load shed that could be more widespread, is the last thing that anybody wants to get at. So we'll do a controlled, localized version to avoid that uncontrollable, more wide area. But that communication there is generally between the control rooms, and those decisions are the last decisions that get made after they've tried everything else on their system, or the capabilities that we have in trying to manage. When you are resource deficient, you'll see something at MISO where we call it our capacity emergency procedures. And that's when you get into MISO providing capacity advisories, MaxGen warnings, MaxGen alerts, and then our MaxGen event steps. And as we walk through those, the purpose of the capacity emergency procedure is to two things. One is to alert our members of where we are sitting from a generation sufficiency perspective. And the other is to communicate to our neighbors that we may be getting tight. We may be asking for help through this. So it's the control room communication out to the rest of the industry and the membership to say things are getting tight. Be on the watch of what's going on. Now, as we walk through those steps, there's different things that we get access to. You can get to the load modifying resources that are considered behind the emergency procedure wall. At a certain step, we're allowed to access those. I think it's our step two, MaxGen event step two, in which we can access those LMRs. Problem with that is not all LMRs have an immediate response capability. Some of them have lead times that are associated with it. So we actually have to predict tight conditions and maybe sometimes call those early to get access to some of those resources behind that are on the more of the demand side or load modifying resources on the system. Also, as you walk through those steps, there's certain directives that we provide. And one of those directives are when we get to a capacity event step or MaxGen event step 2C, that is when MISO directs our local balancing authorities to issue public appeals for load reduction. And it's MISO's in an interesting situation overall. We are the balancing authority for our footprint, but we are unique in having these local balancing authorities as well. And there's some split responsibilities associated with how we coordinate. And one of the splits that we have on that is our local balancing authorities are responsible for their load shed plan. So earlier today, we were talking about, who picks what feeders, who picks what load. From MISO's perspective, we direct because we've reached a situation where we're starting to lose availability to other types of energy. So we ask our members to start issuing public appeals. One of the things that is tough about, especially a capacity emergency, is sometimes you can move really quick into it. So I may be at a MISO event step two, and you say, oh, well, he's still got step three and step four before he gets to step five, which is where would be equivalent to the EEA3 load shed situation. Unfortunately, steps three and step four don't often provide a whole lot of additional resources, and you'll see MISO move very quickly from a MaxGen event step two, EEA2 situation straight into a load shed event. And it sometimes will catch folks off guard if it's not forecasted well enough. And sometimes that's the case when you have generation tripping on your system or transmission tripping on your system. So that's just wanted to give kind of a high level spot of what a load shed looks like from at least the MISO perspective, as we're managing through the resource efficiency and the transmission management on that end. But when it comes to the actual load shed, MISO does direct our members when it's time to shed load. It is MISO's directive to shed that load, and then it's up to our members or the local balancing authority specifically to act upon that immediately and until further notice.
Go ahead, Randy.
I do not understand the local balancing authorities. Who are they? Is that a kind of a committee of members of MISO, or is that a separate business entity somewhere? Who does that?
It's traditionally what you're going to see as your larger utilities that are serving your larger transmission owners are going to, I think, and maybe that's not the right way to define it. Maybe some folks in the room can help me out. But the way I look at it is it's going to be those local entities that are that carry coordination between themselves and maybe some of the smaller entities around them where they're pulling that some of those responsibilities from the balancing authority perspective. MISO is in a unique situation. I don't have the full history of how we got to where we're at, but we are, I believe, are the only VA who share balancing authority responsibilities with a local balancing environment.
So who are they? Maybe Darcy can, it's all of them. Each of the utilities are their own balancing authority for us. Okay.
And it's not a committee thing. You each are your own balancing authority. Mm-hmm.
We end up being what's considered a local balancing authority. So we share the balancing authority registered NERC BA functions with MISO. So the majority of those BA functions MISO does, from balancing load and generation, there are just things that we'll do as far as it's with the metering or the communication that happens with inside our local balancing authority area.
And then is like Cass Electric a LBA, or is Vincota the LBA for?
So Minn Kota is located inside the Ottertail LBA. So the LBA was, maybe another way to say it was, they were the control area prior to MISO. So they had their own boundary responsibilities. And but we've Minn Kota, and it's obviously all of our members are, we're embedded in the Ottertail system, and we're actually in the Ottertail LBA.
Yeah. I learned another acronym.
I apologize for introducing that one.
Brian has a follow-up.
JT, you mentioned going from a level two, I believe you indicated. Sometimes you'll jump right to a load shedding situation, skipping three and four. Are you having catching people off guard, flat-footed? Are you having conversations on how those levels progress and change
Yes.
potentially?
Yes, sir. We've actually been talking about those for a while now. And you know, and I think it's one of those situations that you're seeing throughout is now that they've been implemented through that, you find where the inadequacies are associated with that. And it does provide a false sense when I say I'm at my step two and it looks like I've got multiple steps to go. There's not a whole lot that sits in those steps three and four. So we need to think about that and how we communicate and maybe even how we arrange those going forward to make sure folks understand that if you're in a MISO, if you're in a max gen event, step two, especially step 2C, you don't have far to go before we're in a situation where we may have to make that snap decision to shed load.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so if you have more to add on load shed communication protocols or work, and then your efforts on demand response, it'd be great.
Sure, Carolyn Wetterlin, Xcel Energy. So JT did target a couple places where we don't have a lot of discretion in our load shed, like the equipment overloads where it's pretty targeted. We also have some automatic load shedding that is around system disturbances where it's triggered by under frequency. But we do have, when we do have discretion in our load shedding, we do that on a distribution feeder level, and we've identified feeders that have critical load on it, like the hospitals or things that really need to stay online, and we avoid those at all costs when we do our load shed.
Like water systems and things like that.
Our control center manager is my phone friend. If you want more details, I'm sure he can chime in. All right, thanks.
Darcy Nigam, Montana Dakota Utilities. So similar to Carolyn, Excel, you know, we do have load shedding plans, you know, that are coordinated, at least how, you know, relays and devices are set up on the transmission system if things would happen. You know, we also do, you know, look, if we had a load shedding event, you know, it would be one of those, if there was time, we would work with our local, you know, distribution or region folks to at least to be able to administrate those. But we can certainly do those from our control center in Bismarck as well. And so some of that we've pre-targeted areas that we would look. Most of those are the same non-fire, non-police, non-hospital sorts of loads, and stay away from those critical loads that we end up having. You know, on the demand response side, we've been working to develop, you know, more of those systems. And we have two programs, the tariff service, and then also a third-party service that we contract with for aggregation. So all of those are either industrial or commercial customers. You know, the Capitol building here is actually one of our customers as well with standby generation. So we also have schools that participate in those, some banks, and some of the oil field loads. So depending who they are, they're either just changing, you know, set points on HVAC, there are things that they're turning on standby generation, or we have several that just turn their load off completely, and they'll just take the business interruption. So if we certainly had a load shed, and depending upon what's happening, if it's localized or if it was system-wide, you know, those certainly could be loads we target first if they weren't called upon as well, at least to participate. So as I said, we're looking to continue to grow those programs.
How many megawatts of demand response do you have?
It's about 7 or 8% of our total load.
Okay.
Yep, so it's like 45 megawatts.
Otter Tail?
Tom Herlitschke, Otter Tail. On the load shedding, I agree wholeheartedly with MISO on the comments regarding how quickly things can escalate from a step two, EEA two, up to firm load shedding event. And we talked a lot about the importance of communicating and giving people a heads up. And there's a point in our load shed plan that initiates an email that it's a blast email that goes out to several in our company, including several co-ops that we operate for. And public relations is one of the recipients of that email. So that kicks in our public appeal process. So we reach out to radio stations, TV. We've gotten quite heavy into social media, Twitter, Facebook. But when things escalate rapidly, people can feel like we weren't informed. And that's, so I agree wholeheartedly that finding a way to build a little more time in between when we're getting to a point where we're asking for public appeal, it's pretty serious. And it can quickly get to the point where we're now cutting people's power off. And balancing that with not issuing public appeal too often and asking people to cut load, you know, the sky is falling type of thing. So that is a little, it's a tricky balance there. From a demand response standpoint, we leveraged our demand response quite heavily, probably the heaviest we've ever leveraged it during those 2 days in February. We control 120 megawatts load, mainly on economics. So it wasn't for reliability purposes. It was based on economic triggers, based on LMP prices, what we had purchased in the day ahead and secured to serve our customers in attempt to shield our customers from those high LMP prices. And so that was 15% of our load during those 2 days we were able to control using our demand response system, which I think it's a testament to the programs that we have in place and our customers' willingness to sign up for those incentives and those programs. It really paid some good dividends for us.
Excellent. I mean, Cody, you've kind of covered the demand response, but if you have some thoughts on the load shed communications, et cetera.
I don't have much to add. I would say our processes are very similar to kind of what MDU and Otter Tail. Obviously, we're generally our systems are somewhat intertwined and processes are generally tried to be consistent. So I would say a lot of that is the same. So us being an Otter Tail LBA, we would coordinate with our control center and theirs and with our members when it gets to a point of actual firm load shed.
Good.
So if I understood it right, MDU has about 7 or 8% of its overall load on demand response. Otter Tail about 15%. Could Excel and Coda share? And then I'm curious, are the differences based on just some of the specific loads that you might have in your system, or does it have to do with more how generous your tariffs might be in that regard?
I do have some cliff notes on this, but I think I'd like to call on Carrie Hassler if she wants to respond to that.
Thanks, Carolyn. I thought I provided you with what you needed, but it's good. We have about 850 megawatts of DR on our system that's available in the summer. That's approximately 10% of our load. About half of that, 400 megawatts, is summer only. It's a air conditioner controls either on the condenser itself or through a smart thermostat.
How about either Cass or Minn Kota in general?
So for us, we're a winter peaking utility, so we're about a 1,000 megawatt system in the winter. We control roughly 300 to 400 megawatts, so 30 to 40% So a lot of those loads are going to be heating loads. So we have much, we have a lot more control in the winter than we do in summer, where we have about 100 megs of control in the summer, which is going to be more your commercial and industrial type loads. So about 15% that we're able to control in the summer season.
Thank you.
All right. Good. Okay, so that is the end of the official questions on this piece, but I have one more to throw out here because we are a little bit ahead and I want to be ahead. But because the power transfer was such a big deal from RTO to RTO during this winter event and really helped prevent things from being much worse, I just wanted to get any thoughts from JT or any of the utilities on, you know, how can that be, is there ways to improve that even more to make that more seamless so that each of the RTOs can really be a strength for their neighbors and, you know, back and forth?
Yeah, go ahead, JT.
I was just going to say, you know, the part of it is around how we plan our systems. Very much on the end of, I spent my first 13 years at MISO on the planning side. And when we're thinking about planning in general, we're not always thinking about what it is for the interactions between the two regions. We're looking at our market footprint. We're looking at our local reliability needs. I think better coordination between us and our neighbors. And that's not just, you know, I know for you all, it's important with MISO and SPP, but also the MISO and PJM side of the fence where a lot of those flows were coming from are important. How, you know, when you get in such an emergency situation, MISO in the past, when we've had extreme temperatures, have been able to lean on both sides of our footprint because the cold or the heat was more localized to us. Well, this time it was us and SPP that were struggling with the weather impacts, and we were both leaning on PJM coming over. Those are some of those extreme scenarios that you don't necessarily plan for because you go back to the cost function around that. And those are the things you got to think about, that it is that better interconnectability important. And I would say when you look at the difference between how the Eastern Interconnect survived versus the Texas Interconnect or the ERCOT area in this event, you could, having the diversity of geography, the diversity of fleet, across, because we were able to lean on the entire Eastern Interconnect to help support these efforts. Southern Company, TVA, PJM, and all of its members were all shipping power west, some of it for MISO, some of it for SPP. It was very, very important. And, you know, I think you heard some of the conversations too about economic decisions during these timeframes. MISO had plenty of capacity sitting in its north and central regions during this event, but we were still bringing in 7,000, 8,000, 10,000 megawatts of capacity or energy from PJM because it was economically viable to do. You had folks making economic decisions to run their DR because the prices were too much. There's a value in having that interconnectivity and that capability and that broad market construct in support of not just MISO by itself, but MISO and SPP and how we coordinate in our various economic processes too. It just provides a lot of hedging against reliability risk, economic risk, and transmission is a big enabler of that. And you don't get that type of benefit without having the transmission system to deliver it from broader regions in support.
When we were in the February event, did MISO issue a directive to urge end-use customers to conserve energy, a directive to your membership to urge their customers to conserve? And if so, was it received and did you do it? And then the third part of the question is, how effective do you think it was? Did they actually conserve energy, or did they crank up the heat and do a few loads of laundry right away before they lose power?
So it's hard for me to tell. There were three situations or three times in the south portion of our footprint where we got to a maximum generation event, step 2C, which when you get to that event, that is MISO's It's an automatic directive to the local balancing authority to issue public appeals. Now, it's up to the local balancing authority to do that. And I don't know how widespread or utilized that was. That's at that point, that is as far as we go on that end. Do I think we saw a lot of reduction? I don't think so necessarily. We had some members, I think, in the South, part of our footprint, that reacted much like we heard earlier today here, is you had load modifying resources, demand response customers that said, hey, it's going to be too expensive for me to operate. I might as well take advantage of this and go on my outage because it's not going to make sense for me to pay those high prices that are going to be sitting out there today. That I could see. What I didn't see was major impacts from those public appeals. There may have been some, but I don't know if it was visible on our end.
And the Northern Zone didn't get to that level of issuing public appeals?
No, we MISO as a whole never got to that maximum generation event for the North and Central regions. So we would never have directed any of your utilities in your state to issue public appeals during this event.
Another quick follow-up to that issue. So SPP was 10 gigawatts short, I think, by the math I looked at. And we had capacity in the northern region. Was it a transmission, you know, restriction that kept us from generating and shipping them more power? Or where did those exist?
That would be my assumption, is that ultimately you do run out of transmission capacity to meet those needs, but I am not that knowledgeable in that arena of was there more capability sitting in there. But it's not just the MISO to SPP transmission, it's the MISO Indiana to SPP transmission as well. You've got a lot of that you still got to get across our entire footprint. And I can assure you with the wheeling that was going on, we were maxing out the transmission capability significantly. So unless that unit was sitting right on top of the system, which some of them may have been, and why we weren't trying to buy more, maybe it was the economics that were keeping some of those units offline. I think there's probably lessons to be learned from that conversation to see if maybe the units that were closer that weren't running, should they have been for that? I think that's good lessons to learn from that.
Good. Brian has another.
Yes, Commissioner, I would just add that I think one of the most telling things from the February event was the usage of the big transmission investment that we made in the MVP portfolio. You know, of course, we had that big build of the MVP lines, $7 billion worth of investment. Those were designed entirely to bring power, largely renewable energy, from the west to the east. During this event, they were flipped. And those same lines were very beneficial in helping us move power from the east, largely fossil fuel generated power from the Marcellus Shale, probably, from the east to the west. So it's that resilience aspect that the transmission gives you. I've never heard anybody in our operating system room say, boy, we've got way too much transmission. I wish we had less.
Yeah.
Never heard that.
Right. Okay. There was some talk in the previous session about load shed plans by zone versus load ratio share. Anybody in this panel have thoughts on that? Is that an issue in MISO? Is that something that has been contemplated? I thought it was an... It's interesting that SPP is looking at that.
JT, in a way, what we did with the South event in keeping the load shed in the South, so to speak, is that an example of that?
Well, maybe it is different because we have these local balancing authorities, so you're already kind of just zeroing in on more of a... Mm-hmm. Smaller territory versus no, Darcy
shaking. So the MISO system right now, with how we have a separation between the North Central region and the South through a very tightly constrained corridor, does result in us treating resource adequacy, and thus when we get to a capacity deficiency, it does separate those areas. If we had a continuous MISO footprint, deficiencies would have been more widespread. You would have seen it more like the Southwest Power Pool's application of load ratio share on that end. However, we never would have gotten to that point because we had plenty of capacity sitting in our North Central region to support what we needed in the South on that. We just couldn't get it there due to the transport capabilities. Now, in the South, I can assure you that there are some who are making the same questions in regards to saying, hey, I was sufficient at this point, but yet I was part of that load ratio share load shed when we had that deficiency on the evening of the 16th. So that question has come up, and we'll have those conversations as well. But I think it also goes to, I think, some of the comments that were made earlier as well around, you know, this time you were, but in the South, we've had a number of situations where we've been close to load shed, but not quite there, where the tables were turned and, you know, we were able to skate by or get by on those events because we were able to import enough or get generation online appropriately. So that mutual assurance pool associated with that, I think it's a good conversation to have, but right now we're planning and operating our system in that mutual assurance pool environment. So I think that's something that has to be thought about. If you're going to change what we bring to it, then you've got to change how you're playing together in that role. So that's definitely a resource adequacy conversation that's probably outside my expertise here, but luckily Scott's on the call.
So the fact that the load shed was in the South, not in the North, is a result of that bottleneck in your transmission as opposed to policy. So if it was required in the North, at least across the North area, it would be spread out proportionately. Am I understanding that correct?
That is correct. So if we ran into a situation in our North Central region, we would have a load ratio share load shed that would go from Michigan to Montana.
JT, you might talk about the transmission emergency though that had the small load shed in Illinois where mm-hmm. it was localized, right?
Yes, and the transmission emergency
is different than generation emergencies.
Yes, when you're managing localized transmission, those load sheds can be more targeted because you have to target those, because me shedding load in Indiana for an issue that was in Missouri does not help. It's the Missouri load that I needed to shed, or the Illinois load local that I needed to shed. That's why if in the case of the capacity deficiency load shed in the South, it would have done nothing for me to shed in Illinois, Missouri, or North Dakota, because my deficiency was constrained by transmission into the South. So that's why I'm not going to shed what I don't need to shed in that regard. And that's where it's got to help my system conditions be met. So
that makes sense. Good. Does anyone have any thoughts that they'd like to offer in support of changing the the ratio share to more of a local zoning thing? Are you comfortable with the load ratio share for load shed?
Tom Herlitschka from Otter Tail. I'm comfortable with the load ratio share. So not only does MISO direct the LBAs, Otter Tail, MDU being two of them, based on load ratio share of your total LBA load, then Otter Tail also does a load ratio share. We have several utilities with load in our LBA. It's not just Otter Tail load. We have Otter Tail load. We have Great River Energy load. We have Minkota load. We have East River Cooperative load. So we also do a load ratio share as part of our load curtailment plan as well. So it works well for us.
So at this point, I think we're comfortable with the load ratio share as well, because some of that, if you spread it into smaller zones, it always becomes who are you paired with and are you taking on a bigger risk in that. So from the standpoint of saying we're kind of spreading it much more broadly, it seems to be we're equally sharing that risk.
Sure. Yeah, and I think Xcel Energy would agree with all of that.
Good. Okay, I think that covers the first chunk. Half done, everybody. Let's take a 10-minute break. Be back just after 2:30, and then we'll get started on the the final discussion on markets and long-term reliability, and we'll get to hear from Scott Wright on this one and others. All right. I think we're all back now for the final stretch. We had the, what was it, seventh inning stretch? So this is another really interesting part of the agenda today. And want to dive right in. I have a few additional questions besides the ones we outlined, but I think you heard most of them this morning, so they shouldn't be a real surprise. For getting started, you know, we talked, the three of us immediately after the February event talked a lot about how, you know, there seems to be a lot of just whenever things go bad, go south, a lot of finger pointing. This person's job, this person's job, that organization's role. And what we're the most interested in is just making sure that the lights stay on, who's regardless of who's ultimately responsible. And I think we can all recognize that that is a shared role in this world today. It's shared. And so is also the case with resource adequacy. I personally feel like there's been a fair amount of just pushing the hot potato around on whose job that is. And you know, maybe often it's landing with the states and the utilities that are regulated, but then, you know, where does it land when there isn't regulated utilities? So we all have to take a role in that. So that's why we set out the first question as, what's your role in addressing resource adequacy? And I think that's a good place to start the conversation this afternoon. And we'll go ahead and kick it off with MISO and Scott Wright. You can lead with your title and talk about your role in resource adequacy. And then maybe that's the time to jump in on some of the issues you're seeing and changes that you're proposing as a result of your understanding of a greater role in resource adequacy. So go ahead, Scott. You're still on mute.
Great. Now it sounds like
again. There we go. We hear you now.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, I for some reason this WebEx or this GoTo meeting format is not supported with my computer microphone. So I'm using my phone and the computer, but we should be fine. My name is Scott Wright. I'm Executive Director of Market Development and Design at MISO. Very pleased to be here today and talk about these issues. I think there are a lot of key takeaways to the winter event in relation to resource adequacy. And so I want to talk a little bit about those. At first, I thought I'd make some comments to the commissioner's opening salvo there about roles and how we view those at MISO for resource adequacy. And then I'll talk about some of the challenges and the winter event. And of course, we can ensue with whatever discussion folks like to have. So from MISO's perspective, the resource adequacy is very clearly in our mind, and you've heard us say this before, very much the primary responsibility of the load-serving entities and the states. They have the primary role in resource adequacy. So what does MISO do? MISO creates minimum planning requirements for the region and corresponding financial incentives to satisfy those standards as required. So while the LSCs and states have the prime responsibility for RA, the collective construct with MISO's roles are really important because the MISO role is what creates the tremendous value proposition for all of the utilities to be in MISO, because we set a requirement that's much lower than utilities would set on their own collectively by leveraging system diversity, geography, load diversity, all of those things. So we're identifying a requirement, and the states satisfy requirements in any way they see fit. And every state has different approaches and nuances to it. So in entirety, the collective construct validates that we have the resources we need. And we do that at a system level, and we do that at a state or LRZ level, local resource zone level. We run an auction, 1 year forward basis. It's mostly for incremental purchases and sales, as most of our members, the vast majority by percentage, choose to self-supply, and they're not using the auction to buy capacity, but it is a useful residual market mechanism. And here's a big premise. Our resource adequacy is premised on the availability of those resources to meet real-time demand in essentially all circumstances across the year. The planning standard uses this 1 in 10 notion for shed and load 1 in 10 years concept. But in general, we're looking for an assumption that the resources that we count, so we set a requirement and then we count capacity against it, we're assuming that those resources can convert from capacity into energy when needed. So I say that because our region is under significant change, and a lot of the assumptions we've used in that conversion and assuming we'll have enough when we need it have been entirely adequate and sufficient. But with the nature of the changes happening across the MISO footprint, really from north, south, east to west, they're transformational in nature, and we have a rapid changing of the fleet. And we have lower excess reserve margins in general. Compared to when MISO first formed, we had 25, 30, 35% reserve margins. You know, we're usually hanging around the planning standard pretty close to it now, in the upper teens. So with those changes taking place, MISO 2 or 3 years ago started an effort called Resource Availability and Need, where we look at Scott, availability.
Yeah. Scott, really quick, I think before we get into the RAN, now that I've rethought this, I'd like to get everybody else's take, quick take on resource adequacy, and then we'll get into the changes, because I think you did a nice job of outlining MISO's view of whose job it is, and I'd like to get the load serving entities, LSEs in MISO talk, otherwise known as, in my world, utilities, get your guys's take on whose job resource adequacy is, and then we'll come back to you with the RAN initiative. Carolyn.
Sure, Carolyn Wetterlin again. We see there's a couple of different roles in the resource adequacy. We develop our integrated resource plan based on the reserve margins that MISO sets, and we have a pretty robust process here, and we file those plans with the commission. We're also very active in MISO's long-range transmission planning effort to make sure that we've got a reliable, cost-effective transmission system out there to actually get those resources to our load. I have two friends online to help me out in this topic. It's very important. Farah Mandich is on, and she can talk a little bit about our resource adequacy strategy. She's our strategy and planning analyst. And then Drew Siebenaller can answer any questions on the long-range transmission planning effort. So Farah's online right now.
Thanks, Carolyn. And thank you, commissioners, for that question. I think, you know, what Scott was talking about in sort of setting up the construct is really where we, you know, where we, what we use as a starting point for our planning. So, you know, we make sure that when we do our long range planning, we're taking into account, you know, our forecasted load plus the planning reserve margin that MISO would set for us. And we also take into account the resource adequacy values for each type of resource that, you know, we would, put on our system. And, you know, kind of this sort of gets into a little bit of maybe the next topic, but, you know, we also recognize that there is a large transition going on in the system. And so we've also kind of adapted our modeling tools and processes to make sure that we're accounting for, you know, resources that would come on our system that maybe aren't dispatchable in the same way gas or coal plant is. And so really shifting from, you know, our planning process from taking into account primarily only the summer peak to a planning process that really incorporates, you know, customer needs in every hour of every day through our modeling tools has been really helpful in getting, you know, getting to that next step in planning for those new resources.
Good. Excellent. Anything different from Montana MDU?
Nope, but the same thing as far as to our integrated resource planning. You know, we do take a look out what our load requirements are and at least what's required to have generation to meet those accredited capacities. We do appreciate, you know, in the 2021 North Dakota legislative session, the House Bill 2067, you know, and at least the ability for the Public Service Commission to review those integrated resource plans. And we think that's a very positive thing to have those discussions instead of having to wait for a rate case or something down the road, at least where there's some other docket to look at this. So, you know, we do see this as a responsibility that we have and certainly do participate, you know, with the various MISO stakeholder groups, you know, whether it's on long range transmission plan or just looking at also, you know, those stakeholder groups that deal with resource adequacy.
Thank you, Darcy. Otter Tail?
Otter Tail, I would echo the same comments as Excel. You know, we take a look at their planning reserve margin requirements and look, I'd say we're engaged enough to consider a variety of scenarios that MISO might be considering, you know, that I think we'll probably get to with regards to the construct, and then the possibility of changing accreditation levels that might be coming too. So, mm-hmm. you know, that setting, understanding that requirement, and then a variety of scenarios that might be coming up in the future.
Okay, very good. And then Minn Kota, same?
I would say it's pretty much the same. I would say that we all have a responsibility. So obviously we have a responsibility to our members. Understanding how you meet those obligations according to resource adequacy is part of trying to identify what your resources are going to look like. And one of the challenging things when you look at your long-term plan and making sure you have adequate resources is the timing of the assets. So the age of your assets, when you're adding new resources, how do you maximize the value of your resources, some of the things you're out of your control. So those are things that make it difficult on the resource planning side of things. But it's a responsibility of the entities working with the RTOs and legislation to come up with a plan so you have adequate resources.
So Todd, what I think I heard you saying is you come up with a plan, but the market has an impact on what you plan.
Yes, the market has an impact, political pressures. So environmental attributes are different things that are going to affect or impact what your resources need to look like, understanding what your neighboring utilities are doing and kind of making see if there's a way to make sure that your plan lines up with others. So, you know, when you're a small utility, you generally were joint owned units in a number of us at the table here. I don't know if that's something that we'll be able to do in the future, but it is something that has been beneficial over the years. But it is one of those things that is part of each utility's challenge when it comes to resource adequacy.
Brandy has a follow-up.
I'm curious for anyone who wants to answer it. When you talk about having a responsibility that Scott said it belongs to the LSEs and to the state, do you see your responsibility as having adequate energy on your lines, or is your responsibility to meet the reserve margin set by MISO?
Darcy Nagam, MDU, I would say it's both. I mean, one is we have to make sure that there's sufficient energy, you know, around what our peak days are, but also on the energy side, you know, to make sure that it's as economic as possible. You know, the challenge gets to be sometimes in resource adequacy, what we look at, or, you know, potential, you know, directions that may be state-centric around having certain requirements is ultimately who gets to keep those benefits becomes a challenge sometimes. And so we talked about this as kind of the all-in-together model. You know, certainly there are benefits that come to us and our customers, you know, through the MISO proposition, the value proposition. But yet, if we get into places that we're either overbuilding too much, it's the question ultimately who benefits and gets to keep those costs or values. But you know, it's kind of a both. How do you economically meet demand and also the energy requirements? And that's what we plan for.
Anybody else want to jump in on Randy's question?
hearing lack of response, I hope that someday when it happens that we don't hear, well, we met our percentage requirement, and so, you know, we were responsible. Because if it's not enough, it's not enough. And I hope companies are looking at that.
Okay, so thank you, Randy. Scott, you heard everybody's response, which, yes, recognizes that you guys set the requirement. But what I hear is a lot of focus on what MISO is requiring. and so while you, MISO, sees this as primarily the role of your load serving entities and the states, you are setting the stage in a very significant way in terms of what shows up. And so I am really interested in hearing your thoughts now on and your kind of highlights of what you've seen in the system and as the changes are occurring in this transformation, both in MISO and throughout the country, and how that's directing what you guys set as your requirements for your members. Requirements and market incentives, I should say, since they're both part of it.
Okay, great. Yeah, so I think it hasn't fallen short on MISO at all for setting its requirements, and we don't have a lot of excess reserves. And the risk profile is changing, that we've got to really be all about the business, about how we feel, about how we can model the risk, understand the risk, incorporate the risk into those requirements. So that's something that we've been very focused on working with stakeholders over the past two or three years. One part of that has to do with the changes that are taking place, which is, as everyone has read, and we've documented this in a series of reports we call MISO Forward Reports going back several years now. The nature of the trends that are affecting the industry and the footprint, really with an accelerated build-out of variable energy sources, an accelerated retirement of legacy thermal resources, and sort of a signature on the risk profile that has a lot more variability and uncertainty in it. So it's not just the theory of what's coming at us, but it's been a reality that we've been living through the last few years. And so we don't have to think about, well, exactly how will things change or pinpoint it. We can just say it's right here on our doorstep, and this has been shown by us going through significant, severe, tight conditions and generation, maximum generation alerts and circumstances that JT and his shop help us navigate across all seasons of the year. And so we have a good track record now of being in these tight conditions and having to cause a call on LMR, load modifying resources, demand response, or maximum generation capabilities, and that's the reality that we have been living in. So we look at the trends and we say, is that going to make everything better, neutral, or worse, or more challenging? In general, on balance, we think the trends are going to make it all more challenging. So this suggests a great motivation for us to move quickly and make changes, but not in haste. So what are the things that we need to change where we know perhaps we have some vulnerabilities that we can shore up? While knowing they may not be exactly perfect, they're aimed in a very, very solid, good direction that we can build upon or refine. So those are the things that we have in motion. And a lot of this, a lot of work, both on, you know, setting requirements, and then how do we count capacity? Because that's really important. In these extreme situations, what can you count on in all of these different circumstances? The winter event is just one of many. It was significant. It was severe. But I remember a lot of this getting motivated from the 2014 winter event and engaging, and then all kinds of events, even in the fall and spring seasons. So that's a little bit about how we see, and so we take it, we don't take it lightly, this business of setting the requirements. And so we've been modifying our models about how we characterize risk and set the planning requirements on many fronts. How we model renewable energy, how we model forced outages, how do we model load, how do we model seasonal dynamics and planned outages, because that's a very important part of managing capacity is managing planned outages throughout the year. So this has all been underway. We've made many reforms, and stakeholders have been a huge part of this process with ideas and pushback. And so we've got some good work behind us, but we also have some big lifts, you know, right in front of us that we're planning to make filings at FERC in September of this year to help address these risks. And we think that more work will be needed over time beyond those, but we really feel like we can't wait. And we've got to, you know, keep the engagement going, working with our members. And I'll talk more about what those changes are, but I wanted to provide that initial response to your question.
That's great. I think it'd be good to hear some of the highlights on the seasonal construct and the capacity or not capacity, accreditation.
Okay, great. So the winter event is really a great sort of poster child for really needing to understand what capacity you can count on across the seasons of the year. And so many years ago, we took up this conversation with stakeholders about this fact that we don't have the excess reserve margins that the region has had. But that's good. We're serving load with less, you know, invested iron in the ground and resources. We're serving customers more efficiently. And so that's a good thing. But we've got to manage the risk at the same time. So the need for reforms is there in front of us. And so the idea of the seasonal construct is really just a recognition that the risks are different as we go through the year. The drivers can be quite different, and the resource capabilities are quite different as well. We may not need as many resources outside the summer peak to serve some of these other seasons, but the resources we do need, we need to know, have a high level of confidence we can count on. And so that's what's fueling a lot of our exploration of the seasonal construct. We have a firm proposal on the table that we're now refining and getting feedback. But I think we have pretty good general support for moving to the seasonal construct with stakeholders, because I think folks recognize this. And the other part of the seasonal construct is I think folks recognize that, you know, a lot of the resources that we do have, you know, the planned outages are really important. You know, they keep those resources going when they're not on planned outages, and they're a key part of having a reliable fleet. And a lot of the resources are seeking more flexibility to not have to be present or be counted upon when they're doing those planned outages. And so we're hoping to enable some flexibility for those resources to maybe choose not to participate in a spring season for a long duration nuclear outage or a coal-related outage, what have you, and just make it easier because the fleet is aging and some of these resources have different needs and different economics. So we think the seasonal approach just makes sense on a lot of fronts. Different seasonal needs, different seasonal capabilities, and enabling some of these economic outages or outages due for a number of reasons on a seasonal basis.
So just in a nutshell, for my colleagues who haven't heard a lot about the seasonal construct, you're going to require your members to have different requirements for each season and then show their resources into that for that season specifically, bid into them. And how, right. how are you accrediting the, well, I guess that's still up for discussion, isn't it? How you accredit the actual each of the generation resources for the season.
Sure. Okay, I'll talk a little bit. I'll just say one more comment on the seasonal approach. We think the seasonal approach is an efficiency generator for the footprint. When you think about the value proposition and, you know, how much capacity do we need to meet, and instead of you know, putting out a summer number and say, that's it, it better carry across the year. We don't have any requirements outside of the summer peak planning number. You know, that's it. So this is going to allow us to look at the unique needs of the season as the fleet change. And in general, most of the needs here in the beginning, we think of the early years will all, you know, be peak load in the summer. And so the requirements we impose on generators outside of that season should be less. And that might, you know, alleviate some concerns and stresses. Some of these resources weren't built for peak winter weather. And the needs may imply we don't need them to be counted on as capacity. But so that ability to kind of look at the season and then say, yeah, you know, we don't need as many resources, but here's the type of availability we expect that we can count on. Or if we need to consider other seasonal requirements related to different things. I know many things have been talked today about winterization. Many things have been discussed about fuel assurance. Folks could consider if those sorts of things might need or could be added to a winter season requirement. We are not doing that at this time. I know there's been a lot of discussion about those things, but it's something that's out there that the seasonal construct allows you to kind of look at some different options and levers we could pull to ensure reliability for the region.
Will those new requirements also be distinguished between the southern zone and the northern?
Yeah, the requirements will come out of a big loss of load expectation model, and it drives requirements for each local resource zone, which in most cases, you know, matches some of the state boundaries, and in a few different cases it doesn't. But yeah, it'll allow a different requirements for both, you know, the different parts of the north and central regions and the south region. I think part of that's really important because when you look at what drives risk, it varies. And so this is a nice way for us to make sure our requirements are really reflecting the underlying risk appropriately. It's a perfect bridge to the accreditation topic. I'll just pause. I'll go into that if you'd like, but I wanted to pause.
I think we can move ahead into the accreditation.
And I'm coming to you guys.
Great, thank you. So the way the accreditation is pretty much sort of the way that we count resources versus the requirement. And we have a generalized method today where we look at general availability across the year. And again, in an environment of excess reserve margins and very sort of specific risk drivers that the industry has known for a while, that's been pretty sufficient, you know, and reasonable. What we're seeing now is that a greater need to make sure we can see and count the capacity for the different seasons and those requirements. But importantly, we've been emphasizing also that the availability is very important in those really interesting periods, like JT talked about a lot with the winter event, these tide events, which, you know, we've had a couple dozen of these over the last few years across a lot of them outside of summer, you know, that never experienced before, a lot of them outside of summer. And so we believe there's a real important ability to say, okay, who can show up or what capacity can count in those tough situations? And so we've proposed reforms that account for that and allow us to count capacity looking at how generators, their availability actually during those circumstances. So based on stakeholder engagement feedback, we're refining our proposal, and we're also looking at availability across all hours of the year. And so we think that it's good just to be able to look at it through a couple different lenses and really modify how we think about accreditation. And it's all about us increasing the confidence. It's just about increasing the confidence of what we have to work with. And there's also been some changes we've proposed where we were proposing to include planned outages in the accreditation as well. Because in those circumstances, in some ways, an outage is an outage is an outage. It's not there and we need the megawatts. That is true. But we also have a lot of ways to coordinate with our members and improvements we've made that we can build upon and further enhance. And based on stakeholder input, we're making changes to our proposal to have a lot, you know, have exemptions for planned outages and good coordination on those outages. So we're really talking about enhancing the accreditation for the large swath of outages, of unplanned outages. And so in the winter event, the unplanned outages were the show. The planned outages were there. Some people changed their planned outages. It was helpful. So that's good. But the unplanned outages is where we're trying to make these changes and set us up to have better confidence when we set requirements.
And so in this last event, if a generator was offline when it was supposed to be online, the next time around, their capacity that they could count for that generator would be less. And so they'd have to backfill with more, in a simplified explanation.
Yeah, so the winter events tend to be short duration, but very severe in some cases. And as we saw with this event, for parts of this country, meant the loss of human life. And so in the winter, when you're looking at these situations, it's very important. And the way that we've accredited capacity, and it's not MISO, it's the broader industry in general, typically I've said, if you were out in an event like this, it impacted your accreditation, but I would say it's been fairly de minimis and may not send a signal that something different needs to happen, or the confidence of the capacity should be increased in any way. So we feel like there are impacts for these kind of outages. By no means is correlated in any way to the significance of the event. It's sort of general. You could have had an outage, in a different period of the year when we had an extreme excess capability, and it would count just as much as you not being available in a severe event. And we feel like that's fundamentally flawed, and the industry can't operate that way. Different RTOs and regions have taken different approaches. Many haven't taken an approach yet. We feel like we need to get in front of this and set up a system that counts that availability when we need it the most. And then generators, again, primary responsibility. How do you meet those requirements? The load serving entities in the state can say, well, for us in our region, here's what makes the most sense, and here's how we see the risk, and when we look at costs and trade-offs. And so that's what we're really trying to set up, is that folks can look at those standards and think about the tools in their quiver and make the changes if they're needed that make the most sense for them.
Good. All right. Thank you, Scott. I don't see my colleagues with any questions for you. So I'm going to turn it over to the panelists in the room for a few minutes to respond to with knowing kind of the new stage that MISO is setting on resource adequacy. How do you expect it to affect you? How are you going to be your company's responding? And how do you think it affects fuel diversity? One of the issues that we saw being a concern in this winter event, how will it impact the changes that they're proposing? How will they impact your response to that?
Carolyn Wetterlin, Xcel Energy. So we have been very supportive of the seasonal construct. We think that is going to be very helpful in managing the outages. But I do want to take a step back to Commissioner Christman's comment about meeting MISO's reserve margin. I don't think that we see that as, MISO has set the minimum requirement. We're very active in the stakeholder process where they determine what that reserve margin is, the loss of load expectation, and see that as a stakeholder developed formula that comes up with that reserve margin. And the reserve margin is intended to share the risk of a generation not being available. And we think that we're part of that solution in developing what that reserve margin is through the stakeholder process. So along with the diversity that we have in our portfolio and meeting that reserve margin, we fully intend to be able to serve our load and if need be, contribute to others who haven't have an issue or if we find ourselves in a position to have to lean on others. So I think it's a little bit less than just meeting a par that ISO has set. So I just wanted to add on to that.
How about, do you guys have thoughts on the accreditation? I don't know if Carrie's still on the line, but how does the accreditation, how do you think that's going to affect your units and the long-term diversity of the fleet?
Carrie, can I call on you again?
Sure. I will jump in here as my camera comes on. So we are, like Carolyn said, supportive of the seasonal construct. We are supportive of the direction that MISO is taking with the capacity accreditation. They've made several changes in direction in the last week or two. More details will be forthcoming tomorrow, so we'll see how that rolls out. But they've definitely incorporated outage coordination and prudent outage planning so that those units aren't penalized in the capacity accreditation. So definitely supportive of that and supportive of a tiered structure that looks at all hours and looks at the tight hours as well. When we do our resource planning, we look beyond just meeting those minimum requirements. We look at what is it going to take to reliably operate our system and serve our load. And an example that we always bring up is in the winter, solar is covered in snow, and so you can't rely on that capacity of a solar unit when it's covered in snow. So how do you incorporate that into your resource planning process? And so Farrah alluded to this a little bit, but we incorporate some different reliability calculations to determine what is the mix of resources that we need that may not just be the most economical based on MISO's capacity accreditation and planning reserve margin requirements, but what will also provide that reliability to the system as well. And as part of that, we've been advocates for MISO to develop capacity accreditation that looks beyond the next planning year. For example, an ELCC capacity accreditation calculation for solar. So as more solar comes onto the system, the value of that solar to meet the peak load becomes less and less as that net peak load shifts out to later hours. So we would like to see MISO develop some more forward-looking capacity accreditation so we can incorporate that into our resource planning methodology and our models and look out beyond just what's the issue for the next planning year, but what is it going to look like out 20, 30 years?
All righty, MDU.
Darcy Nigam, MDU. So we've kind of been probably, late, comer as far as being supportive of MISO seasonal construct. We kind of had concerns or probably more questions. I think seeing where we've been, the winter events of 2019 and 2021, there are things that we do support to get that more granular view as far as, what resources are available and specifically their performance around those peak conditions. So I would say there are things we support. The other question around, the fuel diversity and pieces, and we look at that on our gas turbine side. The historic units we built were dual fueled. The most recent ones, because of economics, were gas only. So depending what happens with rules, it may be something that we come back in, from a commission standpoint and look to get recovery, at least on adding that additional capability on those resources, if it's something that's needed in the future. So it's something that we would look and hopefully the commission is supportive of.
At Outer Tail, we're developing our current resource plan now, and the impacts of the seasonal construct, as a winter peaking utility, certainly our required resources will go up considerably in the winter. That is balanced a little bit because the peaking facility that we just constructed in South Dakota will have significantly more output in the winter than it does currently in the summer. Currently, it's accredited at the peak day in MISO in the summer day, but we'll get an additional 30 to 40 megawatts out of that unit in the winter. So that will cover that. You know, when we plan for the retirement of coal at Hood Lake, and we added both Astoria dispatchable resource and the wind resource here in North Dakota. So, you know, we considered that that diversity as we considered that retirement, I guess, for Hood Lake.
I don't know if I have much to add. I mean, I would say on the resource adequacy and the accreditation definitely will impact what resources utilities, including ours, will look at as far as meeting your obligations and maybe understanding what the indirect impact it has on the fuel supply side of the equation, like you had mentioned, and also the transmission. So they maybe don't address that directly, but depending on what resources you have, you're going to have the infrastructure in place to be able to accommodate those resources. So it's just one of those things that we're, what they're doing as far as trying to be prepared for all hours of the year, I think is a good thing. And at the end of the day, we'll have to figure out what resources are able to accommodate that.
My questions are more in the 30,000 foot level. So if you want to stay on these details.
You go ahead. No, go ahead.
Sure.
Yep.
I don't know if it was going to, my questions are not on these specific details, but much more general with resource adequacy. And I feel like we can talk about capacity accreditation and tiered structure and the seasonal construct and lose track of what I find so concerning when I look at MISO's responses to our initial questions. And I see your expectation of your coal generation in 8.5 years from now being about a third of what it was in 2016. And that's about 33,000 megawatts. And after all that earlier discussion about what was done to prepare for the February event and people making sure that everything was up and ready to go, and what would we have done if we had 33,000 megawatts less coal? Well, I guess that's going from 16, but I think it was 33,000 less from 2021, actually, and it's a third of what was there in 16. And it seems that the solution to eliminating all that coal is adding about the same amount, about 33,000 megawatts of gas. And I just, to the extent that we're seeing gas added, it's not dual fuel. We already know we couldn't afford to run our new gas plants during the February event because the gas was so high. Two of the utility companies are in. We're taking early action on your natural gas costs for your straight gas customers. And I don't understand, where is all this gas going to come from to do this?
I'll take a shot at that because I think you're referring to the numbers that we have in our futures, which are the numbers we use to reply to the question. Okay. So the 2030 nameplate capacity that we have in our futures is the roughly 21 gigawatts of coal versus roughly 54, which is your 33 gigawatts reduction. Our futures, particularly future one, represents our view of the aggregation of the plans across the footprint. So it's, in a way, it's not our view. It is more the aggregation of the plans that we see people putting together and describing to us. We've had to fill in some gaps in that process, but we're particularly Future One is not to represent our view. It's to represent what we think people are telling us they want to get to. So that's how we do that. And so that's on the retirement side. as far as the capacity that's required to fill that, they also tell us about the carbon reduction goals. So we model and ask, okay, if that's your carbon reduction goal, what's the most effective and reliable way of getting there? So the planning models that we run sort of pick the resources that are in the combination to serve that load under that scenario. That's what Future One is. It's one of three scenarios. And the models say that, our models say that that is most often, it's a lot of renewables, as we know is already baked into the plans. But to back up those renewables, you also have to add a lot of gas, because you end up with some of those load shapes that you have to deal with and some of the risks you have to deal with renewables. You're needing a lot more flexibility in the market. So if you're retiring the coal, and again, that's the assumption that we're hearing from our members, if you're retiring the coal, MISO is saying that, and our models are saying, you're going to need a lot more flexibility than you have today. And the most likely cheapest source of that flexibility is going to be a gas unit from a new construction standpoint. So that's all that's saying. We're not picking gas over coal or anything like that. We're just saying, well, you're going to have this sort of load shape in that future. And to hit that load shape, you're going to need more flexibility than you have today. The only thing that's we have in our cost set of cost curves for the future that does that real well is gas.
And while I understand it's not MISO necessarily calling for this as much as just telling us what your members are telling you they intend to do, but are you pointing out that it's not going to work?
I think we're saying it's not going to work unless you also add these other forms of flexibility, because you are effectively retiring flexibility with the coal generation.
The flexibility of adding the natural gas.
The flexibility that's added by the additional natural gas, yes.
But we already just found out that there wasn't enough natural gas to go around for what we have.
And there are lots of other places. Well, the natural gas is the resource that is projected to be available. Yes, there are challenges around natural gas, but it's also viewed as something that is prevalent in other parts of the footprint. And a lot of this gets back to, this is why transmission is so important, so that you can connect to the other regions of the country and to other parts of the footprint where that flexibility and the better gas resources would be available.
If I might, I think it might be helpful to hear from Scott on this issue too, just in terms of, do any of the market changes that you're proposing address this concern? I mean, I've asked this question too and heard, like, that's why you're doing these market changes, to try to affect the viability of the long-term resource plans and the market in which they're operating in. So maybe that won't be as much gas. Maybe some of these other units will not retire because they'll have a better accreditation. There'll be other influences that help affect these decisions. So Scott, I mean, what you laid out, which is very granular, Randy, but it gets to some of these issues of trying to direct where the market is going long-term. In terms of the resource availability, do you think you're going to affect the fuel diversity in some of these plans? Or do you expect everything to just continue to lean on gas for long-term dispatchable generation?
Yes, I think the main emphasis here is that we're trying to focus on the needs and the capabilities, you know, regardless of where they come from. And the fleet that we've had has provided a lot of good availability and flexibility to meet what we need. The excess reserve margins have been thin. The risk signature is changing. So we continue to emphasize, and we think these reforms point at, you know, what are the needs? And, but I, so it's fair, you know, it's very sort of a technology agnostic, fuel agnostic, but then you have to look at the reality of what will get built and how it will happen. In a way, the reforms, I think, are important because if we have concerns with gas availability, the reforms should provide a fairly good signal that if we need your resources, whether they're coal, gas, what have you, in the winter, we're going to look at how you did in those tight winter conditions. And if you didn't show up, we're not going to count on you anymore, or we're going to count on you a lot less. And so that helps folks, you know, take a look at, huh, what are my options for the gas vulnerability we have today? There's a tremendous amount of variety in the approaches taken all over the footprint and the risk on the gas side. But there's a lot of options there too. They involve cost, and so I'm not unaware of that, but at least forces a conversation that can happen. A lot of folks who own these gas resources have invested tremendous money in upstream contracts, storage resources, a variety of things, some backup fuel, to make sure that they're there in all conditions, and they show up, and that's really important. But we have a lot of these gas resources were built for summer peaking only, and they haven't maybe made all the conversions to their cost structure, their contracting structure, and they haven't felt like they've needed to. But we're just saying we're in this period where needs are changing, and so we may have to rethink some of those things. And so a very important thing we're doing, because I've heard the word mentioned many times, I think 7 times, long-term. So these construct reforms, they set up the kind of the playing field of the requirements and how we count. But we also just got to get a lot better visibility on what this means and what this should mean to investments and retirement decisions. And, you know, a one-year resource adequacy process from MISO where we count each year as we go is useful, but not as useful as it needs to be. And so we're also launching this project called the Regional Resource Assessment, where we take a look at these gaps and vulnerabilities that have been mentioned here about the capabilities we may not have, accelerated retirements, where we get rid of capabilities we might desperately need, implications to gas needs, gas infrastructure, gas supply. That is part of this project that we're launching. We're going to publish our first version this year. But it'll look out 5 years, 10 years, 15 years to inform, not set requirements, but to start helping folks who are, the states and the LSEs are doing these 10 and 20 year evaluations. And we're trying to provide something that'll be responsive and helpful. And I feel like even when I say this, we're not moving fast enough. So I feel really bad. And so we're trying to really get on that and to paint this picture and show where the gaps are. And we can talk about, so what are the capabilities we need? Essential reliability services, flexibility, ramp services, different things we don't have today to really shed light on it.
Commissioner, I think JT had a comment.
Okay,
to help there
go ahead,
too.
JT.
Okay, caught me off surprise there. Yes, so one of the things that was mentioned in regards to, especially the gas supply issues that we're running into, I think what we're finding more and more because how the fleet is changing is that the natural gas transportation environment just has a different model in how they build their capacity versus how we utilize that capacity from an electric infrastructure perspective. We're gonna eventually gonna have to have a meetup if we're gonna have greater dependence on natural gas fired power plants across not just our footprint, but across the country, then we need to start marrying better the demand on that fuel supply and how those transportation and how those pipes are built across the footprint. Because right now you're not going to have a combustion turbine trying to buy 20 years of firm contracts of a natural gas that would support that pipeline to actually get built. That's just not where it's where we use it. But that natural gas, that combustion turbine is one of the most important units on my system when it gets into these tight capacity situation, because they are the most they are the most flexible and can start on a dime if fuel is there. But there's a disconnect in how pipeline transportation is built versus how we need it. And that disconnect has got to be satisfied if we are going to continue to see such a transition happen so that we don't run into fuel supply constraints when we need those resources.
Carolyn?
Yeah, commissioners, Drew Siebenaller is trying to get his video up. He may be disabled, but he has some thoughts on this conversation.
Okay, great. So,
Drew, you want to give it a shot without the video?
Yeah, sure. Am I coming across okay?
Yes, you are.
Perfect. Thank you. Drew Siebenaller, Manager of Regional Transmission Planning and Analytics for Xcel Energy. I think this conversation, it's a great conversation. I think it goes a little bit further than just gas. This is a fundamental conversation in planning, and that's diversity. You need diversity in all aspects of planning and all aspects of system operations to be able to maintain reliability. That's more than just fuel diversity, that's load diversity. With the integration of more storage resources, that's time diversity. Being able to expand that use over time a little bit better than we can now. So I think it goes a little bit further than just gas. If you look in our resource plan, our current resource plan that's developed, we shifted from calling out firm peaking or gas to firm load supporting resources. It's kind of a small shift in language, but it's a huge shift in meaning. Which it's really trying to get across the fact that we don't know what it's going to be. We don't know it's going to be gas. As utility planners, it's our job to really understand what the system needs, where it's needed, when it's needed. As JT was saying, it might be fast start. It might be ramping, something that a CT does really well today, but it can't be a CT because that might be too expensive. It might not be the most economic way to meet those needs. So it's really about knowing what attributes the system needs and being able to solve those and have an adequate supply of diversity and attributes on the system to maintain reliability for any condition. So I think it's a good point that typically when you hear of a coal plant going away, that gas is being thought of right away to replace it. But I think that's a fundamentally flawed way to look at it. I think that's ignoring a large portion of other opportunities that are out there to be able to meet those same attributes. So I think one of the things we need to do as an industry is really move away from that fuel designation for resources, and we need to start talking about designation of attributes instead.
Drew, do you need the market to change in order to do that?
I think it would help. My view, I'm a transmission planner, so to me, the market just makes things a little bit easier, get some incentives out there for people to do the right things. I think the market can provide those incentives to make all of this smoother, easier, provide revenues where it's needed, something like voltage support or system stability that's kind of compensated for now, but will be more important in the future. Having tools like that to incent the correct behavior, incent the correct attributes of being on the system. But I think it really gets down to maintaining a robust planning process that looks at things like LOLE and reserve margins as a minimum approach to what you need. It's a good goalpost, but you really got to know what the system needs to be able to maintain reliability using those tools.
Thank you. So I'm curious how the other utilities here view this in terms of the requirements versus the incentives versus, you know, what you guys do on your own to meet your obligations. You all said pretty strongly at the beginning, like when your resource adequacy starts with meeting the MISO resource adequacy requirement. And so I'm interested in how much does the market play a role in how you meet that market rules and then also the minimum requirements or other requirements on MISO. And if you feel like things are going in the right direction.
So Darcy and I again with MDU. So one of the pieces, I mean, we get back into planning and if we look at the future, I mean, as Drew said, it is about diversity. And I think when we do resource planning, that's what we're looking at. What's that diversity, at least, that we have in the portfolios that we look at? you know, part of that is being able to meet needs of customers every hour. The other part is reliability, and the other part comes back to economics. And so those are kind of the balances that end up occurring, you know, and if, and certainly, you know, we plan to, you know, where we're at for our load and planning reserve margin, because that is a requirement, but it gets back to be the place, there comes a cost at least to overbuilding. And some of that overbuilding is required depending how you diversify and what's part of the portfolio. And certainly the market plays a big aspect into how do you have that diversity? And some of that gets back to be depending what others do in their neighbors as far as those types of resources. You know, it has impacts on the market and pricing, you know, at least that if you take a different approach to diversity, you can take advantage of some of those lower price periods, maintain reliability, and turn around and maybe plan for those unavailable periods when some of that other, you know, intermittent resources aren't there. You can have something that helps firm some of that. You know, I had brought up before, you know, the concern we had, at least in gas prices we saw in the February event, certainly we hadn't seen those before. You know, it was a consideration we had when we didn't dual fuel, you know, our most recent gas resource, because we hadn't seen the problem. There wasn't a requirement. You know, we could have gotten gas, could have run that resource. You know, it's on the doorstep of SPP. It probably could have supplied some of their load and avoided a load shed. But as we look into this diversity, how it all integrates, it didn't. But it's one of those pieces we'll have to go back in this diversity of fuel. Let's take a look at what would it take to add, you know, that alternate fuel and weigh that in the cost against the risk. And it's all part of that diversity, you know, that we end up having to show that we have a reliable and an economic system that we plan for.
Just want to echo, too, that down at Astoria agreed, you know, there was not the OFO, the operational flow order, so we could have operated Astoria had we needed to operate, and we wondered if we would need to operate or somebody would ask us to. It didn't happen. And then I just want to echo a similar comment to what Darcy said. You know, I really don't think up at Solway prior to February that the unit had ever been called on to run on fuel oil. And so when we were looking at Astoria and thinking about how would we justify a dual fuel source down at Astoria, there really has never been that example where we could call on to say, you know, it was a needed resource up at Solway. It was installed during a time when there was different rules in place. And so, you know, now that we've seen that, you know, I think we've taken a little different position and we would advocate for, you know, additional support for looking at that dual fuel system down in Astoria. And then additionally, too, when we talk about diversity, I wanted to point out that, you know, we do have some diversity in regards to we're on two separate natural gas transmission lines. So, you know, we have we're on the northern borderline through South Dakota and North Dakota, and then the Great Lakes pipeline up in Minnesota.
I would say I would echo kind of what's been said here as well, as diversity is the key to any portfolio as far as mitigating risk. That is one of the reasons we're doing the research on carbon capture for Project Tundra, to have that as part of our baseload resources, that our coal and that the fuel supply is there. So that is part of, when we look at that, some of our concerns is that the idea that you would move away from like an entire coal fleet like ours to natural gas, that is something that we'd be uncomfortable with as well. So trying to find a way to do that diversity. The problem is when you look at meeting capacity needs and what resources do that today, most people always refer to natural gas. And I think it's one of those things where, you know, we're trying to find ways to find diversity. So that's why we look at our demand response program. We have our WAPA hydro allocations. We'd like to maintain coal in our portfolio, but we'd also like to add some natural gas. So I think adding diversity limits your exposure to just one fuel type, which, you know, results in you to being able to manage more situations without exposing your members to the high cost of that event.
So Drew's point about attribute diversity, I'm thinking about some more, but in the meantime, I want to come back to fuel diversity. And it's a great buzzword for 2021. I mean, we all want to be diverse about everything, but it seems to me that when a lot of you are saying diversity, what you really mean is diversity as long as it's not coal. Because if it's really diversity that's the key thing, when I look at, again, MISO's projections, I see in 2021, between 75 and 80% of the load supplied by two fuels. And they each are very close to half of that 75 to 80%. By 2030, again, 75 to 80% are going to be supplied by two fuel load sources. Except for by then, 60% is going to be gas and 20 the other. You're moving away from diversity, not towards diversity.
I think that's for the utilities more than anything else.
Commissioners Marshall, Albright, Cascone Electric. I just have a comment. You know, when you look at politically, so we have a president right now that's looking at zero emission power sources by 2035. And all day we've been talking about moving from coal to natural gas. Well, natural gas obviously emits CO2. So if we can't use natural gas, then what's the option? I think that's one thing we haven't really even talked about today, but I think it's a huge elephant in the room, and I think it's something we need to be talking about, because if we can't use natural gas and we can't use coal, what then? So I just want to make sure that comment is on the record, because I think it's important.
And I appreciate you bringing it up, because I've been thinking about that. So as we talk about adding to the newest gas plants, a dual fuel ability, well, does it justify if we're going to be closing it down in a few years anyway? I don't know.
That's why the timing of all these decisions make a big difference when you're planning for those resources. You're making long-term commitments, large capital expenditures on those resources. And one of the things that, you know, we've talked a little bit about, I think everybody agrees, is that transmission plays a big role in kind of what happened in this past winter, and it's going to be a big part of managing large events by having a large interconnect that has the ability to transfer from one region to the other, but it's only part of the solution. So kind of what Marshall said, I know when we look at it, we have concerns as well, is how do you get to the next set of resources based on the technology that exists today?
So Honortail and MDU, you guys get a little more time to think about the diversity question, because Farah has jumped up on the screen for Excel and is ready to tackle Randy's diversity question.
Oh, well, I think I would just echo kind of what people have said, various people have said already. I think having a long-term plan is essential, because you are in some sense signaling the market about what kind of investments you would need going forward. I think for our own planning in particular, I think Drew mentioned that, you know, we are planning for not just gas additions, but a broad range of additions that can meet those diverse needs. I know that when we think about, you know, if we were going to build new gas, having fuel security is a huge topic that we think about internally. So, you know, when we do our resource planning, we're not sort of just putting numbers into a model and spitting out a future plan. We are kind of in, coordinating internally to make sure that those sort of qualitative aspects of, you know, what if we're going to build a gas plant, what does that gas plant need to have to make sure that it, you know, sort of can be relied upon in some of those more extreme situations. And so I do think, you know, we are sort of taking that diversity point into account. Even with, you know, in our currently proposed plan, we're trying to extend one of our nuclear plants as well. And that's an important aspect of meeting both our environmental and our reliability goals. So I think it's a multi-faceted problem that we're trying to navigate as we transition away from sort of the more traditional fuels to a more flexible system. But those are things that we think about quite a bit when we're designing a plan that we put forward.
Ready?
Darcy Nigam, MDU. And again, just, you know, Commissioner Crispin, following on your question of diversity, you know, I would agree that diversity needs to look at all fuel types. And we do continue to include, you know, coal, at least in our futures when we do our resource plans. So we've not stated any sort of goal or any sort of, you know, movement, at least away from those, other than the ones, the older, smaller ones that we retired at Lewis and Clark and Heskett. And I think we showed that was driven largely by the economics of those projects, one being small and what their ages were. But it's one of those pieces. We know our customers have paid for those coal plants. We continue to see them as important. It's just going to be, what are the challenges it's going to take to continue to maintain those? And we'll have to weigh those against them on the diversity side. What are the other options? But it's something that we continue to put in our plans. But yet there's certainly from the, either it's on the federal side, or at least we end up with just even the social pressures, even though we're in a, you know, a pro-coal state for the most part, there are things from a business atmosphere we're going to have to take a look at and see how does that impact those decisions. But, you know, our current diversity plan does include coal, at least remaining in that for the foreseeable time frame.
I think your point is taken, Commissioner. And I was echo too that we still have coal as our, you know, we still have, 380 megawatts of coal in our system. We have natural gas. We have natural gas backed up by fuel oil. We have oil-fired peakers, we have wind, and we have low control. So we currently still do have some diversity in our system. But I think your point is taken.
Tom, from the Chair, Otter Tail Power. Another thing for consideration is how this diversity factors into our restoration plans. If we had a blackout of North Dakota and South Dakota, we have a solid plan today that's based upon our water reservoirs, our hydros, our coal plants, restoring the system back in a way that keeps it stable. And I think we have yet to determine how these multiple new gas units are going to factor into that restoration plan, particularly given what we saw in February. Are they truly going to be available? What is the storage capacity in the pipelines? Can we count on those gas turbines to start as part of our restoration plan? Or do they need to be left out like solar and wind are today? So that's going to be something that we do have to work through and understand. I think we've identified the interdependencies of the gas industry on the electric utility industry. And there's been a lot of work done since 2014 on trying to get those two groups working more closely together so that we can build some confidence into our restoration plans and count on those gas units to help rebuild our system if we need them.
Do you think that this increase in use of natural gas for electric generation is going to drive up the cost of natural gas in North Dakota in the winter for consumers?
I think one of the pieces to be seen, certainly, you know, the natural gas, the pipeline of production does have its own supply and demand that it does have. And certainly investments are certainly tied to the cost of commodities, you know, and at least wherever the demand need is on transportation. And so I think it's one of those pieces, the gas industry, you know, when we talk about this, either the coordination or at least the level of investments, you know, there's going to be something. I think if the price of gas becomes higher, at least that we'll end up seeing the gas industry will do to basically try to capitalize and at least to basically have more production or more pipelines in that space. You know, probably one of the things that's been an impact is at least on the, if it's the shale gas, but it's just the low, low price we've seen in the commodity side of gas lately. There isn't a lot of incentives, at least when gas prices are $2, to go and try to add more into a $2 sort of market. And so I think there's going to be some way that balances out. And at least, you know, at least I think we continue to sit well, you know, based upon where we're location, at least to production, if it's here in the Bakken or at least other source of gases that's available to us. You know, we're not at the end of the pipe.
Brian, do you have a follow-up?
No, actually, I don't have a question. I was just thinking how we could morph back into not a browbeating conference, but a technical conference. So, and that's not the intent. We've all expressed concerns over the supply of natural gas. but also recognizing that, and it's refreshing to hear looking at it from a more regional standpoint, because where a gas plant is placed, and we saw this on the heating side, not on the electrical side, but different utilities have different arrangements, leases in place in terms of their supply of natural gas. And if you have 50% leased storage to satisfy your winter heating needs and or running a gas plant versus 25%, and those are some numbers approximately from different utilities, it's a different equation. And I think in terms of the attributes of that plant that is in close proximity to low price natural gas or more reliable delivery of gas is greater than one that is removed from that type of a scenario. So I think it's fair to say, as different ADPs come in for different projects in the future, I will certainly be looking at them in a little different light and taking those things into account. So I think the recent event underscores how to take be more regionally specific, more asset specific approach to how these things are accredited moving forward. So, and that's what I'm hearing, and I think refreshing, and at the same time, I agree in terms of when you look at the coal generating facilities, they are critical, and I think we're a long way off. Still, probably. Well, I'm not going to give a time frame, but I know that's the aspiration of the current administration. But I think there's just a significant. It's a quantum leap to think that we can go from where we're at today to that position in just a short period of time. So just some thoughts.
Thanks, Brian. I think that's kind of an interesting segue. There's really two little areas I'd like to still talk about. We'll finish with what we can do, or like North Dakota can do or not do. So be thinking about that, advice you'd like to give us. But I would like to talk a little bit. Todd, you've mentioned this a couple times about the policy drivers and some of the concerns with the previous clean power plan that came out. And I think it's fair to assume we're going to see something like that in the next few years. Something from the current administration. I mean, they've thrown out some pretty lofty goals. But I've heard MISO talk just from a, factual standpoint about the challenge of the timeline, the raw challenge of getting the infrastructure in the ground to meet the goals and what the cost might be of achieving the president's plan. And I didn't have that written down, but I think, Brian, your organization has talked about that some. So if you wouldn't mind, just it's a bit of a reality check to what is needed to accomplish some of these aspirational goals of going carbon free by 2035 or carbon 50% by 2035 or whatever the goal might be. Would you mind sharing that?
Sure, I'd be happy to talk about it, but I have to go back to our futures, which I just learned is a fairly dangerous path to go down.
Well, it's confusing. But
talking about things, because we talked about future one in that path. It's one of three. Our most aggressive future is actually future three. And the big difference between as you go across futures one, two, and three is the assumption on electrification. Because really, the policy discussion is not just about the electric sector. A lot of it is around how do you use the electric sector to electrify the entire economy? And that has a dramatic impact on our industry. I mean, we have not had load growth for 10 years, 12 years, none. But if some of the electrification objectives are met, and then you're decarbonizing the rest of the economy through electricity, it means we need a lot more energy being generated and put on and we're going to need a lot more grid to get it to where it needs to go. So there's a massive impact in just the amount of literally our 20 in 2040, our future three has more than double the amount of energy that MISO generates today in it. And that is, that's a dramatic thing. There's also, I talk about that future three because that future three is the most aligned future with the Biden announcements or the administration's announcements from a carbonization standpoint. Because again, he's talking about decarbonizing society. So our future three gets you to about the decarbonization objective then. But our future three only gets us there in 2040. I think he's got a much more aggressive, the administration has a much more aggressive timeline, in the 10 to 15 year timeframe. And that's hard for us to envision how you get there that fast. I think time to achieve is probably the hardest variable to predict in any of this. Because I think these transitions will take longer. They're going to require a lot of transmission, and transmission, as we demonstrated, the MVP process takes a long time to build. Nobody wants to site transmission, and that's going to be—it's going to be a fight every step of the way. If there's a disconnect, is primarily around how long it's going to take to get there.
What's the price tag that you guys have looked at for future three in MISO?
The price ticket for future three, given the amount of additional generation that you're having to add, in addition to the transmission, total price tag is probably in the $500 billion range, $500 billion.
And if you're
you may have heard the reports around our future three has transmission up to $100 billion, which is an estimate I think Claire put out there. So that number's out there, but the generation number that's also embedded in that, the new generation investment and utilizing those different forms of generation, we're in the $400 billion range. So 400 plus 100 billion, $500 billion.
And that's, if you accelerate that, it's only going to get more expensive. Achieve it, it would cost more because you're trying to do it faster.
One would think, and I think you need to treat that as a marker of this is what it would cost if we do things like we're currently doing them. And it was that $500 billion is an eye-catching number, but it reflects doing usually basically the same set of resources and other things like that. I mean, if there was a dramatic change, some change, and I think a lot of our plans, contemplate we're going to need something new out in the future to get to that last 20% of reduction, because that's going to be the hardest part to get, is that last piece of it, to get that last decarbonization. So it is a challenge. The timeline is particularly a challenge. I think we don't have to look past California to say what's going to happen. California is ahead of us, obviously, in this transition. They're ahead of the rest of the country. They've been trying to retire their older gas plants on the coast for a long time now. And they can't do it because they need those gas plants to stay active and there. So every year they keep re-upping their gas plants to keep them going. So I think you'll see the equivalent across the rest of the country, and it could be gas, it could be coal, it'll be something, because we're not gonna let everything retire and let the lights go out.
Right.
I mean, that's just.
So just for comparisons too, I think it's good to remember that the MVP portfolio, which was a huge deal, cost $7 billion.
Yeah, $7 or $8 billion.
And we're talking about how you inflate dollars to achieve this next plan. So I think it's just important for people like us to share those that reality out there, just to keep people engaged in that. And then just in terms of $500 billion, I mean, that, like, people don't, we've lost track of what $1 trillion is. So I have a new mission in life of reminding people what $1 trillion is. So here's my favorite way of doing that. If I spent $20 a second, how long would it take me to spend $1 trillion? You guys can't, you've already heard this, so you can't guess. 1578 years. So that's $20 a second. I just spent $100. I just spent $200. So, I mean, we just have to keep our minds engaged in the amount of money we're talking here and in reality. So, all right. Thank you, Brian. Final tranche of questions I wanted to throw out there, and then whatever else we want to do for cleanup before you get to wrap everything up, Brian, is
one more cleanup when you're done.
Okay. What do you want us to do? What can we be doing? And this is for, you know, Scott, JT on the screen, or Farah or Carrie, whoever. What can North Dakota do to address resource adequacy? What should we avoid doing, if you have suggestions for us?
Yeah, this is Scott. From my perspective, you know, continue. Well, I see North Dakota getting, you know, really being engaged, rolling the sleeves up, calling out these questions, very, very helpful. The regional resource assessment is going to really benefit by having stakeholder insights that put these issues on the table. You know, and I'm talking about that report because it signals this 5-year, 10-year, 15-year, where are we going discussion. And have we called out the risk that we need to? So I think that's really important. And then understanding what the different RE reforms mean to the members in the state and the implications. We have a lot of different players on the phone today with, you know, different size companies, winter picking, summer picking, different things like that. So I think that's really good to be mindful of those impacts, and we'll be working with those members so they understand what this means to them. The call for urgency here is just so significant in our view. I mean, that's why we call it a reliability imperative, because we think it's an imperative. It's not a sort of an reliability option, or, you know, a reliability good thing to do. It's the reliability imperative, and the winter event, all the things we talked about here in this pace of change are driving it. So, you know, the continued partnership and ideas, and also pushback and bring up those concerns is really helpful.
Thank you, Scott. Anybody else?
What else North Dakota can do?
Yeah.
My survey back home was really just a continued involvement, or even increased involvement in the RASC committee of MISO, so resource adequacy subcommittee. I know North Dakota's involved with it, but mm-hmm. That's really the pressure point, I guess, is what I heard back home.
Adam, that's you and me. And Darcy, the folks and the utilities, but anybody else?
So one, I appreciate this dialogue today. I think these are very important, and to have these type of conversations, you know, to share, you know, perspectives and I think concerns that we have, and at least to take a look at, you know, whether it's the bookends for the future or the challenges ahead of us. But so I thank you also as well for your participation. I think it's very important, you know, at the RTO levels, the time you spend and your staff, it's much appreciated. Continue to do those because you bring great perspectives. I think that at least helps balance the conversation that's out there. You know, and Commissioner Fedorchak, thank you for bringing up the analogy, at least on what is $1 trillion. It's one of those pieces, certainly, you know, it's to keep in context. We can throw numbers out, but the other one I've never seen when we talk, if it's half a $500 billion, what's the impact to the retail customer just in that component? And it's the piece we look at, we need to do these in the cost, but eventually somebody has to pay for it. And what's that adder on top of all of our other distribution costs? And at least to kind of know where we're heading, I think is a very important. So I certainly haven't tried to play the numbers out myself, but it would be, I think, good to look at that and something we carry in front of us. We talk about all these things. Ultimately, what's it going to mean for the customer? Are you going to pay, or what's it going to look like for them? The other thing I would at least, I know you, that the commission had input, so at least some of the work in the last legislative session. I think a number of those bills are really important and were very helpful, I think, to our industry. Whether it's the coal severance tax or the reliability studies that are out there, just that ability to look at integrated resource plans as well, to have those dialogues. So I thank you for that as well, and I think those are important.
All right. It looks like we have I'll just
chime in here. This is Carrie Asa from Excel. I too echo what everyone else is saying and appreciate the time and the discussion today and the questions around resource adequacy. And I did like the analogy, Julie, that you had, Commissioner Fedorchuk, sorry, of your father telling you not to get out over your skis, because of course I'm in Colorado and we're skiers here, so I really appreciated that. So, I just wanted to touch base on, there are some market issues that we can deal with in the near term. I know you've been supportive of the multi-day financial commitment for the long lead and long runtime resources that appears to have gone by the wayside by MISO. But there are other projects that they're working on under their forward market mechanisms, or whatever they're calling it these days, for the long run times and the long lead times to ensure or to provide more transparency about what the market is looking like a few days ahead, or to know that once we start a coal unit that it's going to run longer than 24 hours and the market should take that into account and make the market participants whole for that. So there are some market issues that we can address right now in the near term to help with that transition so we don't get out over our skis. So I appreciated that as well.
Good. Scott, I hope you heard that. That was for you. All right. Okay. Randy, you had another question or two?
I do. I have another question, but first I'm going to say, now that you've contemplated the 1500 and whatever it was years at $20 a second, maybe you could calculate a half a trillion dollars and then figure out the population of MISO state, MISO region, and how much is that per person. I'm just thinking that's $10,000 or more per person. If the people know that, how anxious are they for the changes that they're demanding of these companies? But my question is, it's causing a confusion from our pre-filed questions from MISO. On pages 9 and 10, and it was question 4B, which is what could or should FERC and NERC do to mitigate these risks more uniformly? And I'm just not getting the overall picture of what you're saying on these two pages, because just for an example, I'm looking on page 10, the commission, I think FERC you're talking about, should consider allowing flexibility to the existing regional priorities and challenges rather than mandating one size fits all obligations. I could highlight some more. We've heard discussion here today about, that I took as things that some market changes could be done to improve the situation we're in. But then in the first paragraph of this section, you also say MISO recently published a white paper called Redefining Energy and Ancillary Services Markets, highlighting that MISO's markets must adapt, but then go on to say this, and this is where I really get confused. MISO does not see the need for any further RTO market design rulemakings. So it seems like we're discussing and talking about all these market design changes, but then saying you don't see the need for any rulemakings. Please help me to understand the message.
I can comment to that, Brian, unless I'll give you a chance there if you wanted to say anything introductory.
The only introduction I'll say is I think that had more to do with capacity markets and PJM. But I'll let Scott fill that in too.
My perspective on that is that we feel like there's a lot of things we need to do in our markets, both in resource adequacy and the operating time horizon, you know, the real-time markets. What we've been trying to signal is a lot of times one-size-fits-all FERC mandates maybe don't reflect or best align with what we think the reforms and markets are needed in MISO. And every time we go on one of those projects, it takes away very precious resources we need for other things that we might deem a higher priority. And we're in a very constrained environment replacing our market system. It's a massive capital investment spanning many years, and it really limits what we can do in terms of these enhancements that are needed. So we're trying to accelerate it and get it done as fast as possible so we can make some of these changes. And so so that the paper, Redefining Markets, outlines the types of things we think we need over the next decade. But we'd like to be able to work with our members to identify gaps and constraints and issues unique to our market and maybe not have them federally imposed.
Would they need to be federally approved, though?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, very important. But that's a great basis of a prudence review. Here's the needs. Here's solution alternatives. Here's solution proposals. They would need to be approved. So it's a difference between we'll be very active at FERC, but it's a difference of active with the things that we think are the most helpful versus things they're trying to accomplish, you know, with national, you know, policy goals or market changes. And there's some overlap. Sometimes those things, you know, overlap, it can be quite helpful, but in other cases, to us, they can also be quite challenging.
Thank you for explaining that.
Okay. Anything else, Randy?
No.
Okay. Well, I'm going to kick it over to Brian here to wrap up, but I wanted to say thanks to all of you and everyone on the phone. You guys provided great information today, responding to some challenging, sensitive issues. But I do appreciate the candor, and I think it's really important that we carry the candor beyond the walls of this building and share it with others, not in a confrontational way, but just, you know, straightforward, like here's what's going on and here's the reality of it. We'll get there. These reforms will happen, maybe not on the timeline everybody has in mind, but I think that eventually technology is going to make a lot of this stuff and even more interesting things possible. So thanks for being here and being partners in this whole process. Look forward to continuing working with all of you on these issues moving forward.
Well, since I know I stand between you and the exit, I'll keep it brief. And actually, two of my 3 points were just covered. So I wanted to thank everyone for their willingness to be here. I thought the information was enlightening, certainly invaluable in helping make decisions going forward from a commission standpoint. And when I say commission, I want to reiterate that it's not just the three commissioners, it's the staff members that you see and the others that you don't see. We have one of the smallest commissions literally in the country when you look at our area of responsibility. We're active in the energy sector, obviously, rate regulation, a host of other things. And we do it with literally a handful of people, but they're incredibly talented. And suffice to say, it couldn't be done without them. So for those here in the room, those listening, thank you so much for everything you do. And this is really about looking forward. It's not about fixating on the past, although using the past as a lesson learned, the recent event, as well as others that came before it. So I look forward to continuing the dialogue. And, you know, each and every day, there are millions of individuals across the country, hundreds of millions that are served by electricity. And they can't fully know, and that's fair, or appreciate what goes on behind the scenes each and every day. And it goes off without a hitch 99.99% of the time. And I'm sure your phones are ringing off the hook with people saying thank you every day versus that 1/100th of a percent when something goes wrong and there's a 90-minute outage or whatever it might be. So thank you so much for what you do. But obviously, there are challenges ahead, but I am incredibly confident that the right people are in the room to address those challenges, and we'll figure it out as we always do. So thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
Great.